to the November 2nd, 2020 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission. I'd like to thank everyone for calling in and being available virtually for this meeting this morning. But due to COVID-19 and the virus effects, today's meeting is necessary to be conducted in this fashion. Members of the public that may be on the phone are encouraged to make comments and ask any questions during our business session, which will take place later on this afternoon. This morning's meeting is a study session. Our business session typically starts at 1 o'clock. We will see how our agenda goes today. Today we have all five commissioners on the phone, as well as General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Walquist, and Rebecca Garvey, Clerk of the Board. They are all in the boardroom. This morning we have a Pledge of Allegiance and an HPI minute with Dan Pace. And Dan, I wonder if you'd be kind enough to lead us in our Pledge of Allegiance this morning.
Yes, you can hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. If you all join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, and with liberty and justice for all.
Thanks, Dan. Please share, if you would, your safety moment.
Yes. Good morning. I'm here today to provide a learning moment for a switching job at Mission Substation. I'd like to start off with a review of the district's operating principles, which are also a philosophy. Through continual learning, which is why I'm here this morning, we can constantly improve the defenses that protect us from the errors all of us can make. Here are the five philosophy and principles. Number one is we all make errors. It's a matter of when, not if. These errors follow a recurring pattern and are predictable and manageable. Curiosity drives us to examine our practices and learn from our errors. As employees, we are the solution, not the problem. Excellence is not the absence of failure, but the presence of processes and defenses. Please think about these philosophies and principles. There are two main teaching points that I learned from and I would like to pass on to all of you. The first is situational awareness, and the second is a questioning attitude. First, situational awareness brings us to the word STAR. This stands for stop, think, act, and review. Stop and think. Ask yourself, what if and how? This is different for every job that we do, but we want to make it a habit in order to put ourselves in a mindset that covers our situational awareness review. This is a must for all jobs, not just complicated ones that involve PTPs, test plans, TOAs, required sequences of steps on a job, etc. Reviewing the situational awareness especially helps us when working alone and not required to do a PTP. Second is a questioning attitude. This needs to be learned so that we can put into practice with everything that we do automatically. This also brings us to the word STAR, stop, think, act, and review are also steps of a questioning attitude. If we don't stop and think, we aren't engaging our mind in the process of what we were doing, the hazards present, the qualifications needed to do the work, any tools we may need to do the work, and what we could do if something happens, and to do a review afterwards. Kind of a self-check to be sure we are leaving the job with everything operational and safe. Are there any questions?
Dan, I think that's good information that you shared with us, and it's very true. Appreciate your calling that to our attention. Once again, it's really a matter of being reminded, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing how fast things can change on you out in the field. I mean, just a minor upset of your routine or whatever you're doing, and you find yourself in a situation you don't expect.
Yeah.
And
very true. Well, great, Dan. Thank you so much. Commissioners, any comments for Dan? Well, Dan, thank you. Appreciate it. You have a great day.
You too.
So, Commissioners, we have an agenda in front of us. Any item on the consent agenda shall be subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon request of any commission member. Do I hear any such request? Rebecca, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Have we lost any of the commissioners?
I don't think so.
No? We think they're all here.
Okay. I didn't know if they heard my comments about our consent agenda.
Yep. I'm good.
Okay. So if there's no interest in moving anything to the consent agenda, we shall move forward. Steve, would you be kind enough to introduce the CPO winners?
I would really like to do that. So this morning, we're going to celebrate some folks who took it upon themselves to do something to reduce fire risk for the district, and we're really proud of them for doing that. Peter Chismar, Dave Fisk, Ryan Mathena, and Shane Renslow were all involved in an event on August 20th where there was a caller reporting in that there was a tree on a line out near Lake Wenatchee. There was no arcing, and the call actually came from a former fire chief, so it could have been assumed that there was the line was actually on it, or the tree was actually on a communication line, but it was not. And they decided to act in a very cautious way and an appropriate way to try to minimize fire risk by continuing to assure that the line was not carrying electricity. Turned out that there was a problem out there that could have resulted in a significant fire concern. So we're proud of them for stepping up, that we definitely have been trying to engage our employees more in addressing fire risk. This is a great example of folks who have done that. We hope that they are able to join us. Now, these are system operators, which means some of them all of them are on 12-hour shifts. Some of them are resting at the moment. But let me just check and see who was able to join us on the line this morning.
This is Ryan Mathena and Shane Renslow at System Ops.
Terrific. Ryan and Shane, we welcome you this morning. We really pleased you're able to join us. You may know that we always give folks who are Cycle of Personal Ownership Award winners the opportunity to share anything they'd like with the board if there's something they would care to, but no requirement to do so. So this is your chance if there's something you would like to share.
We'd just like to thank the board for recognizing us, and it's not a light moment when you have to turn the power off to a bunch of people. It's kind of a scary moment. You don't want to do it. You know, some people really expect, you know, they have issues or stuff like that, and it's not a big deal, or not a small deal. So it was a nice team effort by all of us. I thought we all kind of picked a certain thing to do, and we talked through to each other, and I thought it was a really well-executed moment.
And Shane, would you like to offer anything?
No, just to echo what we had talked about. You mentioned we were trying to prevent fires, and so the USGS fire alert was on high alert, so that flag was on yes, so that essentially brought our attention to it to make sure that we were being thorough with the information we had, and verified that with a couple different tools, not just our SCADA tools, but with our PI tools. And once we realized the data was accurate and there was an issue, we came to an agreement as a team and executed it.
Well, we really want to thank you. Certainly other utilities have incurred significant liability associated with fire risk, and there's no way to know whether this might have been one of those events, but certainly it was a high fire risk moment in particularly that section of the county, and it was a very wise decision. We appreciate what you've done there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ryan, Shane, this is Mr. Arson. I would like to echo what Steve Wright said, that this could have been a real problem. but because of your diligence and perseverance to keep an eye on this thing and the actions that you took, you prevented what might have been a terrible outcome. So we really appreciate you taking that action. Thank you very much, and thank you for really keeping an eye on and safeguarding the district and the district assets.
Thank you very much, too.
This is Steve McKenna. Commissioner McKenna, Ryan, and Shane, thanks for your efforts there. I have a question. So was the tree leaning up against the wires, and how do you go about removing a tree that's on the wires? I've fallen enough trees to know that when that thing comes down the second time, when you start to move it, it can cause a lot of damage. So I'm just curious, do you grab onto it, or what's that process?
Well, you make sure the line's de-energized, and apparently when they got up there, it was in the power line, and there was some evidence that it had started to conduct electricity, you know, and started to, it would have caught fire at a certain point in time. But, you know, honestly, I think, you know, the line crews take care of that stuff, and that one, I don't know how they got it fixed, but, I mean, they take that pretty seriously, but they're pretty proficient at that.
Commissioner, we'll take that as an action item, because I got to admit that I don't know how they do it either. So probably be a good one for us to learn a little bit more about. We'll get you some information about that.
Thanks, Ryan and Shane.
Thank you.
Commissioners, I would like to just finish with this thought, because we did talk a little bit about preemptive public safety power shutoffs last week. This is not an example of that. That would be a case where we actually did not have any evidence of there being a tree in a line, and yet might still move to preemptive shutoffs in order to reduce fire risk. That's something that we're still evaluating. I would expect we'll spend many, many months evaluating that. I know we mentioned it at the last board meeting that we're beginning to consider it, so I would expect it probably be the spring before we come back to you and talk further about that. So just wanted to make sure we were clarifying that what we talked about last time, this is not an example of that. This is a policy that we did adopt a couple of years ago, that if we have a reclose that we're going to be really, or an opening that we'd have to be very careful about reclosing before moving forward. So to the team, thank you very much, and really appreciate the work that you've done. Shane and Ryan, if you would pass along thanks to Peter and to Dave as well. Tell them that we missed them, but we appreciate what they've done.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Commissioner.
Okay, well, Steve, if you would like to take the next agenda item.
Okay, so next up is our quarterly district performance plan update, and you all are familiar with the fact that the way we go about this is we do it by exception reporting, so we will only be talking about the ones where something has changed since the last board meeting. So I would like to begin to invite up managing directors, and we will start with John Stoll.
Good morning, Commissioner.
Pardon me, can I just ask a quick question of Rebecca? Rebecca, are we able to go into our board notes and follow along there and still be on WebEx? Can we do them simultaneously?
I believe so. If you switch screens without leaving the meeting, it should remain running in the background.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Well, good morning, Commissioners. John Stoll. I have the first one. This is the customer satisfaction survey. We had a goal to be greater than 90% in customer satisfaction. We just fell short at 86%.
Good morning, Commissioners. Justin Erickson, Managing Director of District Services. I have the next couple items. First one up is the solicit for 2021 public power benefit projects. We did miss the September 1st target, partly because of the fiber acceleration discussion and allocation of PPP funding for that effort. But we are finalizing our process, looking at how we engage the public late this year, and we anticipate a presentation before the board, hopefully at your November 16th meeting. So more to come on that effort very soon. The next item is waiver of day use park fees. We had a goal to hit the 2,000 mark by December 1st. Thanks to COVID and all the interest in recreating outside, we actually issued about 3,400 passes between that and our public engagement efforts this year. So we very much exceeded that goal. So that is complete.
Justin, a quick question.
Yes, sir.
Since we issued more passes, did we stay within our budgeted amount?
Yeah, I think what actually happened, so in comparison, last year, for instance, we hit about 1,700 passes of our 2,000 goal. And so when you look at where we anticipated the budget for this year, I think we exceeded it. But when you look at it collectively for the strategic planning cycle, I think we're still okay with the overall budget.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioners, I have the next one. It's under the hold the annual joint planners meeting that has been completed for the year.
Good morning, Commissioners. This is Kirk Hudson. I've got the next one at the bottom of page 2, Hydropower Research Institute. We had a goal to add a new contributor this year. It's going to be tough to do given the COVID environment. However, on the positive side, we added a new member in New York Power Authority. The next one, page 3, Rocky Reach Discovery Center, K through 12 Teacher STEM Summit. This one is red, and the reason it's red is the STEM Summit was scheduled to be here in Wenatchee, and with COVID it was handled virtually, and we were able to take care of 3 sessions for the elementary teachers, but the middle school and high school sessions we had planned were hands-on demonstrations, so we weren't able to complete those as those required in-person performance, and so we're still planning to try and do that in 2021. I've got the next one as well on page 4. Hydro capability goal of 73%. Our actual as of quarter 3 was 71.7%. You can see there's a number of moving parts to that. Mainly the issues were at Rock Island Powerhouse 1 and some increased outage time associated with C3 at Rocky Reach.
Commissioners, I have the next 2 on page 6. These have to do with customer utilities asset management. Under 2B, develop asset strategies for 5 critical assets. Those are currently work in process. We anticipate completing them by year end, but we did not meet the August deadline. The following one below is a caution as well, because that's linked with that and putting a strategy in place around those. We have that as a caution.
Commissioners, I have the next 3 items under Q2, 3, and 4, and they were all completed and completed per our anticipated schedule. So the first one included completing the feasibility assessment on project ideas originating from our Horan area outreach effort. Those ideas and that planning effort has been concluded. And then that dovetailed nicely into our request for early action items that you're familiar with and our engagement there with the Audubon Society. So that covers 2 and 4. And number 3, finalize relicensing staffing plan, consultant qualification requirements, and finalize list and scope of baseline studies. We've got that information complete. We're ready to engage with our prime consultant into the new year, and we've got those 2 project manager positions incorporated into the proposed budget. So we look forward to hitting 2021, sprinting, so to speak, on our effort towards relicensing. And then I've got the next two as well, 3A and 3B. 3A is was completed on time, and that is notice to proceed with GMP. That was approved on August 3rd. And on 3B, we were hopeful that we would have our notice to proceed with a guaranteed maximum price for the service center project by December 1st. We do anticipate that that's going to be on your agenda in January. So very close to the deadline, but we are not going to quite meet that target.
Commissioners, I have the next three. The first one is on gaining agreement with Department of Natural Resources for proposed state legislation. This certainly has been impacted by COVID-19, be able to focus, but work is still underway, so that is a caution at this point. Moving down to V on distribution reliability, we had a goal to replace 13 miles of small wire. We are not quite on path to meet that target. We had 13 miles as a goal. We're about 8 miles at this point, so we have that as a caution with the potential to meet it if the weather and the work plan agrees. Closely related, we have replacing 5 miles of end-of-life underground distribution cable. We are making progress, but we've identified we won't meet the target of five, so that's why it's red. However, as noted, we are doing lots of underground vault installation, so we are set up to do replacements going into the future. Moving down to the next one, this is under the substation planning. We had a goal to complete the bid construction work for OMI substation. That is red. The bid has been awarded and work continues on, but we don't anticipate having that completed until spring of 21.
This is Kirk. I've got the next one on page 10. This is a goal to execute 80% of our capital plan as measured with the budget. We're currently at 64%. This was at the end of the third quarter, forecasting about 78% at year end, gap mainly due to the continued delays on the Rock Island Powerhouse 1 modernization effort.
Good morning, Commissioners. This is Bob Shane, Interim Managing Director for Fiber and Telecom. I have the next one here. Our spending is now catching up with our projects. We had some late delivery of long lead items, which we have now received. And this is part of our core improvements in support of our long-range technology plan.
And good morning, Commissioners. This is Lorna Klimansky. I have the next item, item Y, which is about working with Laputa on an employment-related matter. And the one that we worked with Laputa on was interpretation of the word concurrent for the determination of whether to benefits during the state-paid family medical leaves. And while we were not successful in changing the Employment Security Department's interpretation of concurrent, we have strengthened our connections both with Laputa and between Laputa and the Association of Washington Cities and the Association of Washington Businesses. So I think that we are doing some good work.
Commissioners, I've got the next two on page 11. Up top, successfully meet hydro license requirements, including operating at seasonal fish spill targets. Spill season has ended, and we successfully met our requirements. So that's marked as complete. We look forward to giving you a fisheries update later on in this morning session. Further down under B2, submit information to meet requirements specified in our NPDES permit. Our permit is still under review by Department of Ecology. So since they have not issued a permit, we cannot meet any conditions therein. And so this one is red, but it's not red due to any inaction on our part. We're simply waiting for our permit, and then we will, of course, comply with conditions specified therein. We are hopeful that we'll get that permit issued sometime in 2021 and certainly keep the board updated.
Commissioners, I have the next one at the very top page, 12. These have to do with Dryden wastewater. They have both been completed. One is submitting the engineering plan to Ecology. That has been submitted, as well as the public power benefit funding has been allocated towards the project as we move into the future.
And I might just mention that may not on your sheet show John being highlighted there. So we are on the top of page 12, D, 1, and 2. They were the only two that I think we missed along the way that were highlighted. And now we'll be moving back to Justin further down on page 12.
Thank you, Steve. Under G1, this is with respect to executing our 10-year HCP project survival studies. We did discuss this with you recently, and you approved our contract in September. So that effort is underway and now marked complete. And under H1, this is part of our annual effort related to water rights assessment and protection. And we have implemented that strategy successfully in 2020 and look forward to making more progress next year as well as we cycle through those rights that we have in place or in process.
Morning, Commissioners. Rob Davis, Interim Managing Director of Energy Resources. I have next one on page 14. This relates to our large retail customer development plan, item 3C, developing a strategy for recruiting and attracting new companies under the Schedule 4 rates because of some slowdown in our ability to folks on board with the group due to COVID. This one has slid. The good news is that we do have in place our new Director of Structuring and Optimization, Doug Johnson, and hopefully you'll get to meet him soon.
Good morning. Excuse me. Good morning, Commissioners. Mark Mullins, Director of Enterprise Planning, Risk, and Analytics, and I'm filling in for Kelly Boyd today. I have the next item, Objective 4, Item M, dot 1, which is draft business plans for 2021 through 2025, dated 6/30. This is part of our iterative process with the business planning process. This was completed by 7/31/2020 by design to allow some feedback from the senior management team as we go through the iterative process. So this one is complete.
Commissioners, I have the next one. This is John. Under the metrics and targets for both distribution and water, we have gone back into green status where we're within the targeted range within the budget when it comes to the O&M expenses.
This is Mark Mullins once again, and I have the next item, Objective 5, Item F. The first item, 1, and I will just say that our original plan has certainly evolved over the course of the year. Our intent was to have a mock business continuity test in the form of a partial evacuation of our headquarters to support our business planning efforts. And with that, we are planning on conducting some preparation tasks, which is item number 1, by the end of Q3 to allow that to happen. What we didn't realize is that our mock test would turn into an actual event with, by the end of March, headquarters was evacuated in its entirety as we prepared for COVID-19 and all the things to come. So we are marking this as blue, as completed by 9/30/2020, just with the recognition that things have changed quite a bit in terms of our original intent, but I would have to applaud the entire district for the response to COVID-19. And I also have the next item, which is Objective 5, Item M, Strengthened Security Program, the Cybersecurity Program. And this is specifically on number 3.A, Business Systems Implementing Items Identified in the C2M Priority Matrix. So this is an effort based on an assessment to advance our maturity through cybersecurity. We are lagging behind slightly. Our goal isn't due until December 1st, 2020, so we're putting caution here just as we're lagging slightly behind of schedule, but we're still optimistic that we can reach that goal for December.
This is Kurt. I've got the next one, 5N. This is the goal to achieve the reduction in the FERC-NERC-WEC audit frequency by the end of the year. This one is colored yellow. The rules of procedure have not been published yet. All indications are that they will be published in November, which would then give us the chance and the industry to provide comments related to this. But things are looking pretty promising with some language that would allow the compliance enforcement agency discretion based on risk to determine the audit frequency.
And I'd like to jump in on this one for just a moment, because recall that at least as far as I know, Chelan is the only registered entity in the country that's advocating for this change. And the reason is because we've gotten such strong audit results from our WEC audits in the last few years, suggesting that there could be an opportunity to not do audits here every 3 years, but every 4 years. NERC has been responsive to that, and the information that we got last week, they had told us that they were going to pursue this, but last week it appears that they actually are going to release those rules of procedure about 6 months later than we anticipated, but still on the right track here. So main reason that we're getting there is because of the incredibly strong performance by our reliability standards compliance group.
Hello, commissioners. This is Tracy Yunt, interim director of safety and HPI. This item, safety team visits, is part of our efforts to demonstrate awareness and enforcement and support of the safety program. We've moved from red to green, and we will continue to keep that green with the remaining year and our executives out in the field for the rest of the year. And the next item is also a move from red to green, where we've had the days away restricted and transferred reduction. We've had a little bit of activity due to COVID that moved us into red. We had lower numbers in actual work, but we did have a spike in the month of June affecting our roll 12 date. And we had a case from 2019 cover over into 2020 affecting some of our calculations. So we are moving in a positive direction and green for right now. Thank you.
And commissioners, this is Lauren Aklamansky again. I'm looking at item C1. This is our recruiting goal for positions. At the end of Q2, we had moved this to yellow because we've been experiencing delays due to COVID and dealing with a bow wave of activity that had been piled up. We've now moved this back to green. As of today, we are at 87.5% and hope that we can still make 90% now by the end of the year, although we are still being really challenged by trying to recruit people during COVID.
Tracy again, now still on page 21, H1. This was a work we were doing to improve our tracking and reporting processes, cleaning up a lot of historic data that was input into our system. We're continuing to make some modifications to not only the forms we use, but the content, so that as we use this information to make decisions and use the information to make available on our dashboard, it's accurate and it represents the information that we need. So great work to move from green to blue and completing that effort.
Good morning, commissioners. Eric Walquist here. I have objective 7A related to the GRC. So I'm going to take responsibility for these colors not being perfectly correct. The descriptions on the left-hand side are correct. The blue, which is indicated to be the change in the in A4, that actually should be yellow, and the reds under items 1 and 3 should be blue. So I'm sure I miscommunicated my request on that, so I'll take responsibility. But the descriptions on the left-hand side are the accurate status of those objectives.
And GRC.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Governance, risk, compliance.
The next one is mine, Mr. Kirk. Item 7 there at the bottom of the page, operationalized anomaly detection model. This one is colored yellow just because we weren't quite sure we were going to get to this, but just even since the time we finalized this report, we've made great progress on it. The bottom line with this model is that it's part of our digital transformation process, and generation allows us to get an alert that the signal from some data collection devices are is different than when it is normally.
This is Mark Mullins, and continuing on with the implement technology roadmaps, item 2B, happy to report we are complete with build GIS migration routines, which is getting our GIS data over to the new ESRI utility network model. And I also have the next item, which is 2D, conduct and complete cross-functional GIS business process improvements. This is a cross-functional effort across the district that is ongoing and underway, but the majority of the work has been pushed out to 2021, so we are calling this one red, as we are not going to meet this goal for the year. We need to develop some consistency across the district as a whole, and it does require a number of resources to make that happen. So calling it red at this point, even though it's not due until December 1st.
Commissioners, this is Bob Shane. I'll have the next one, 3B. Our portal implementation has been delayed, partly because of COVID, but also as we evaluate the functions of the new system, we are taking our time to make sure we have the right choices and best choices. So we expect that to be going live in 2021 quarter one, but we do expect to have the system up and heated by the end of this year for test purposes.
Commissioners, that concludes our report on the individual items. I'll just summarize by saying that at the end of Q1, we thought we were about 62% headed towards green. By Q2, we're down to 56%. Q3, we're at 54%. This is low for us, as we've reported to in the past, relative to where we've been in previous years. There's no doubt that COVID is having a significant impact on our ability to conclude work. I do think that things stabilized in Q3. We did not see as much of a drop, and we did begin to see more action items that were completed, although completed after the original deadline established back what would have been December of last year. So we feel like we're making some progress, and hopefully we can continue to make that progress in Q4. Any questions, Steve, that you might have?
Questions, Steve?
Yes, please.
I'm looking at that number of COVID delay items. There's probably a metric that we don't look at that would be interesting to look at is how the recovery sort of takes place. By the end of the year, that if you had a target to have a project done by the end of the second or third quarter, but it does get completed this year, is there a measure of ultimately how we catch up or not?
Well, you'd be able to see that just by adding the number completed after deadline. So we will show that when we get to Q4 as to the number of items that were just completed late. So in fact, usually we do calculate that percentage number as well. So you see the number that were completed on track or based on the original deadline, and then also the number that were completed, although with some additional late measures. So I think we'll be able to provide that to you.
Yeah, that'll be an important number, especially for this year, I think.
Commissioners, if there are no other questions, we would be prepared to move to the next item, the quarterly financial review.
Steve, this is Steve McKenna. I appreciate the presentation and just want to continue to provide encouragement and appreciation for all of you for your efforts in trying to cope with COVID-related delays and impacts. And I just see this on a daily basis, and I think people just need to get a little attaboy every once in a while and say, you know, from a commission level, we certainly appreciate everybody's efforts and want to encourage you and your staff as they continue to deal with it. So thank you very much from me anyway.
Thank you, Commissioner. I do think that we are, despite the numbers here, we are proud of the fact that we've been able to stabilize this situation and the capability to be able to get work done under what is definitely a difficult circumstance. So thank you very much for that comment. With that, I'm going to turn to Mark Mullins again, who's going to give the quarterly financial review.
Thank you, Steve. Good morning, Commissioners. Mark Mullins, Director, Enterprise Planning, Risk, and Analytics. And today I will be presenting the quarterly financial review for the quarter ended September 30th, 2020. This presentation does support a number of resolutions that require quarterly reporting to the board on compliance with our long-range financial policies, business line financial policies, and our investment policy, as well as the board's balanced scorecard objective of maintaining strong financial stewardship. Moving to the next slide, we will cover our financial highlights today, our third quarter results, five-year look ahead, as well as our investment report and some key messages. This is an update only, no action required. There is some additional items in the appendix, but we will not cover those today. I would note that I'll move through the materials relatively quickly. You'll find that the storyline is very similar to Q2. Moving to our Q3 2020 key highlights, our bottom line results through Q3 are better than budget, resulting in a bottom line of $53.4 million or better than budget by $12.4 million. Similar to Q2, we are reporting lower retail revenues and lower revenues associated with our cost-based contracts. And this is more than offset by our lower operating costs due to some of the slowed project schedules and adapting work to COVID-19 requirements that you've been hearing about in the performance plan just in the last presentation. From a forecasted perspective, a similar storyline. We are forecasted to be better than budget, forecasting to end the year at $64.6 million from a bottom line perspective, or $8.5 million better than budget. Again, our operating expenses are expected to finish the year below budget. We will catch up to some extent, but that will more than offset the impacts of our lower retail revenue and long-term contract revenues, ending the year above budget from a bottom-line perspective. I will note that our capital and O&M project schedules continue to be refined as we go through towards the end of the year, but also through our business planning and budgeting processes, and we do see some expenditures that are shifting from 2020 out to a later period. Our financial metrics are strong. The district is meeting all of our financial metrics. One item I'd like to note that's different than the Q2 presentation is we were expecting to borrow in 2022 to fund a portion of our capital spending. That has now shifted to 2023, given our lag in some of our capital spending, but also our good financial results. So our recommendation is to continue with this report. In meeting our 2020 through 2024 strategic goals, with recognition there still is a lot of uncertainty around COVID-19, so we certainly want to be prudent as we move our projects forward. From a financial impact, COVID-19, we've certainly seen the impacts, but from a financial perspective, everything seems to be very manageable. We're showing our and demonstrating our financial resiliency through this time. Next page. We'll start our overview from a revenue perspective on the income statement. Our service revenue is down about $7.6 million, primarily due to lower commercial sales. We did have some milder winter conditions and also some lower usage as it relates to COVID-19 as well. On the commercial side, it was about 85% usage. Overall, about 90% from a district perspective. And we also have our end-use, off-system end-use sales were also lower as the market price element of that contract was lower than expectations, and the usage is there is lower as well. And the HDL load growth continues to lag behind expectations. That's primarily due to the Diamond Foundry as they continue to ramp up a little bit slower than expectations. I would note that the off-system end-use sale, that is a cost-based contract, so we do have cost recovery for that. So if we see our revenues drop, we have full cost recovery of that as well. On the net wholesale revenue, that is in line with budget, just slightly better than budget. And this is where you'll see some of that efforts with respect to cost associated with off-system end-use sales. Looking at our hydro long-term contract, we are below budget from a revenue perspective, $10.1 million. Our hydro production cost is roughly 86% of spend at this point in time. Hydro O&M is about 72% year-to-date, which is contributing to that revenue reduction versus budget of $10.1 million. Other operating revenue is very close to budget. And for the year, we're expecting our overall revenues to be $14.9 million below budget. From an expense perspective, we are below budget, $27.9 million. When we're below budget on expenses, that has a positive impact to our bottom line. So there are some drivers, and not just delaying on projects with COVID-19, but we did move some of the major work associated with our large units, C-10 and C-11. While we do have some expenditures in 2020, we're moving that out, the majority of that work out to 2022 and 2023 to allow time to focus on the C-237, the smaller units at Rocky Reach to address the trunnion bushing issues. So we are expected to catch up throughout the course of the year from a district perspective, forecasted to be at about 91% from an O&M perspective. On the non-operating net expense, we are slightly ahead of budget, $1.5 million. We have the benefits of lower interest on our variable rate debt, but we also have the amortization of our debt premium regarding the bond issuance that we did in May of 2020. We are seeing some benefits there as well. Total net expenditures are forecasted to be below budget for the year at $23.4 million. So you can see the offsetting impacts with our lower revenues, but also our lower expenses that are greater than our lower revenues, ending up with the bottom line from a year-to-date perspective, better than budget by $12.4 million, and for the year forecasting to be $8.5 million better than budget. Moving over to the balance sheet and looking at our capital plan, capital plan spending is lagging, down $31.2 million year to date, spending $61.3 million. And we are continuing to forecast that we will be about $44 million behind our forecasted budget of $164 million, or about 73% of spend by the time we get to the end of the year. As mentioned earlier, the timing of the projects and the forecast continues to be refined as we go through the budgeting process. But we do have some significant drivers, including all the Rock Island modernization work, the facilities at Rocky Reach and Rock Island, as well as our operations and service center and the substation projects on the distribution system. So we do have a number of projects of significance that are moving those expenditures to forward years. From a cash perspective, we're ending the quarter at $696 million. This is $81 million in our year-end cash at the end of the year. and this is primarily due to our net proceeds of $103 million from the May bond issuance. We are expected to continue to leverage that cash to support our capital program. We're forecasted to end the year at $656 million, significantly above budget due to the bond issuance. We did hold some cash with respect to a retirement that we were intending on doing. We decided to hold a little bit more liquidity in order to deal with the COVID-19 uncertainty. So that's driving that number quite a bit above budget for the year. From a debt perspective, we've also had a net increase of $42 million from our year-end balance, primarily because we've decided not to pay off some of that debt in our plan of finance. And then we have some offsetting scheduled payments of $35 million as well. So for the end of the year, we're expected to be about $73 million higher at $507 million. So looking from a forecast perspective for the 2020 bottom line results in the different categories, and I'll go through these briefly, but we are seeing service revenue down from a forecast perspective about 92%. We see some lagging revenues in the commercial sector for the reasons mentioned with the milder winter, as well as some of the COVID-19 impacts. Our off-system sale is also behind from the market-based price component of that contract, and the Diamond Foundry continues to lag there as well. Net wholesale revenue is relatively in line with budget. I would note that our hydro long-term contract is also, the revenue is down about 94% of budget. This is primarily due to our operating expenses that you'll note is about 91% from a district perspective. But from a hydro perspective that impacts those contracts, expected to end the year about 84% of budget on those. On the non-operating activity, we do have the benefits, as I mentioned, for the debt premium amortization, as well as lower interest rates on our variable rate debt. Again, forecasting to end the year with a bottom line of $64.6 million, about $8 million better than budget. Looking at our business line bottom line results, integrated electric, and again, it's that consistent story. Lower revenue is being more than offset by our lower expenses when you compare against budget. I would note that fiber and telecom did receive a transfer for the public power funding for the fiber acceleration, so they're seeing some benefits there. And I would note to support our strategic planning efforts with the business lines with respect to water, wastewater, and fiber, we do have a reduction in shared cost support as they move towards self-sustainability and to be consistent with our strategic plan. Looking at the capital expenditures, as mentioned earlier, our total expenditures year-to-date, spending $61.3 million versus a $92.6 million target year-to-date. From a budget perspective, this is about 66% of spend. As we move through the year towards through the end of the year in December, forecasted to spend about $120 million or 73% of budget. You can see across the board, both year-to-date and with respect to our forecast, we are seeing relatively across the board that we're behind in our spending. On the electric distribution side, the substation work that I had mentioned earlier is getting moved out into 2021. The Chelan-Manson transmission line is also getting moved, but not because of delays, but we're just waiting for some materials. And the AMI is being pushed out slightly as we continue to move forward with that project. On the Rocky Reach side, a slight modification with the HVAC work that's lagging in spend there. You'll see a majority of our expenditures are sitting in Rock Island with all the work on Powerhouse 1 and Powerhouse 2 with that modernization work. We're continuing to see some lag both year-to-date but also going forward in our spend for the year. I'd also like to note internal services, Rocky Reach, and central maintenance, about $10 million has been moved out to future years as well that is impacting that. So generally, overall, we're going to see a budget that's about 44 actual results or forecast results will be about $44 million below budget from a capital perspective. Looking at our 2020 cash flow year to date, look at our bottom line result of $53 million, add back depreciation of $34 million, and we have earned funds from operations, estimated to be $87 million. We look at how we've used those funds. We've spent $61 million in capital expenditures. Our net activity regarding debt is a plus $33 million. And then if we have the net impact of our accounts receivable and accounts payable, adding $22 million there as well. So we've added $81 million to our cash reserves. Adding that to our year-end cash balance of $615 million, we're ending the quarter at $696 million. Looking at our cash and investments balance year-to-date, we do have unrestricted funds of $384 million. And also would like to note, we also have the board-designated fund that's reserved for our headquarters service center, strategic facilities fund of $50 million, so we do have some discretion there. But we are considering that to be unrestricted funds. We do have restricted funds that support our hydro capital and debt program. And I would note also in the restricted construction funds noted for 2020, there's $89 million there. This is related to the debt issuance in May of 2020 that we have reserved for construction funds associated with the operations and service center and the distribution work. That qualify for those expenditures and how we can leverage that money. Again, ending the quarter at $696 million. Looking at our district's financial policy metrics, I would note, consistent with what I mentioned earlier, we're seeing a shift in the 2022. We are expecting to see a borrowing in 2022. That has now moved out to 2023 as a result of our expenditures and our financial results. So those are noted in yellow here for 23 and 2024, and those are identified because we're within 10% of our financial policy metrics. So I wanted to highlight those there as well. In 2022, we have our days cash on hand. We aren't initiating borrowing in 2022, but I would just like to note that we are within 10% based on our results, so we wanted to highlight that as well. From a combined debt cover perspective, I will note in 2022, we have a 2.08 cover, which is within 10% of our 2x coverage metric that we would like to meet, and that's driven by the large unit Rocky Reach repairs that are moving out into 22 and 23, but you'll see our course of action is just to monitor that metric. You'll see that metric move to 2.93 and 3.006 in the forward years. Moving to the individual business line financial policies, with respect to water, wastewater, and fiber on our operating coverage percentage, our target by 2024, for water and fiber, we are meeting that target. We are within 10% of that target. That's why we're noting those in yellow. And from a wastewater perspective, we are noting that we are lagging behind as where we expect to be for 2024. On the cash reserves, wastewater and fiber are well within their targeted range. We do see water slightly below in 2024, slightly below their $1.25 million. From a debt service as a percent of revenue target by 2024, water and fiber are green, and I would note that we are not meeting that metric for wastewater, but we do have a significant amount of cash above our targeted amount that we can leverage to remedy that metric. As you know, we have the combination of grants and low-interest loans to fund the Peshastin project. We have the Dryden facility where that continues to get some estimates and funding to be determined. So we have some opportunity in future debt decision-making with respect to the wastewater cash and also the debt service to remedy that metric. Looking at our quarterly investment report, as of Q3, our district yield is 1.95%. I would note in Q2 of 2020, it wasn't quite as much of a drop as the number would appear. In Q2 of 2020, we were at 2.5%. However, the Q2 2020 was propped up a little bit because of the bond issuance that we did in May of 2020. So now we're seeing Q3 at 1.95%, but still exceeding our benchmarks associated with the three-month T-bill as well as the S&P U.S. Treasury index. So we are meeting all of our policy objectives and are compliant with our safety, liquidity, return on investment, diversification, and maturity length, which are all cited as part of our policy. So Q3 messages. Our year-end 2020 forecasts are better than budget. As mentioned, the year-to-date results better by $12 million through Q3. Year-end forecast, we do anticipate that we will have lower revenues, but there will be some catch-up in operating expenses, bringing our bottom line closer to what we expect to budget, but still better than budget by $8.5 million. Our long-term financial metrics remain strong, and this does include borrowing, as mentioned, in 2023 during the next five-year planning horizon to help fund a portion of our capital spending program and maintaining our financial metrics. So our recommendation is to stay the course with 2020 through 2024 and our strategic goals, also recognizing that we do have some uncertainty related to COVID-19, but our recommendation is to stay the course and to adapt as we are able to and do so prudently. At that point, I'll open it up for any questions.
Gary, I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mark, would you just reinforce something that I think you said and maybe explain a little further? So we're not... we're going to postpone going out for debt until 23, but we're not going to be paying off debt this year as planned or advancing those payments this year. Did I hear that correctly, or can you explain that to me?
Yeah, so our plan when we went to the bond issuance in May of 2020, our plan was to retire $85 million in debt, in addition to some of the retirements that we also did. But with the COVID-19 uncertainty, we chose not to maintain some liquidity, okay. And we just postponed that retirement until 2021. So currently our forecast is indicating that we will retire that $85 million in 2021. So it's just a timing perspective.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Mark, this is Ann Congdon. I have a comment. Just that you do such a great job. We don't hear from you enough. So anyway, appreciate having you on. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Any other questions regarding the Q3 update?
Commissioners, hearing none, I'll say thank you, Mark, for an excellent presentation. Really appreciate it. As you can see, the district is in good financial shape, particularly given all the uncertainty of COVID. And we are grateful for that, that's for sure. Want to move on to our quarterly fisheries program update. And next up will be Aline Underwood.
Thank you, Steve. Good morning, commissioners. This is Aline Underwood, manager of Fish and Wildlife. And with me today is Thad Mosey, a senior fisheries biologist. So I want to talk about why we're here today for our quarterly update. We're going to talk about the results of an evaluation of the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife as hatchery operator and monitoring evaluation contractor. And then at the end of the presentation, we will give a brief update on our 2020 adult fish returns to date. So with that, I want to talk to you about the hatchery operator analysis. So about this time last year, if you recall, the board directed staff to evaluate our alternative contracting opportunities to operate our hatchery facilities. Last year, if you recall, the proposed 2020 budget for Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife to operate our hatcheries had about a 12% cost increase over the previous year's budget. That was primarily due to a 5% increase in the indirect rate and COLA adjustments for multiple positions at the district. So the board wanted to ensure that the district continues to receive the quality results that we need while paying a fair and reasonable price for services. So earlier this year, staff got together and identified six criteria. We can go ahead and go to the next slide. Six criteria that would provide a cost-effective solution for the district to operate our hatchery programs and to meet the hatchery rearing criteria and outcomes identified in our NOAA Fisheries Section 10 permits that allow us to operate our hatcheries and the hatchery effectiveness monitoring and evaluation plans that are created and approved by the HCP hatchery committees for both Rocky Reach and Rock Island. So we identified the six criteria by which to rank our alternative operators. And those are as follows. We identified fish quality, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. Cost to conduct the services that were proposed. Endangered Species Act compliance. This is the risk of compliance and a contractor's ability to meet that risk, or to meet the compliance with little or no risk. Ease of implementation, which refers to contract administration, things like ease of invoicing, managing our stakeholder relationships. Our next criteria was ESA fish handling and diversity. So this entertained that not only does the proposed contractor have the ability to and experience handling ESA listed fish, of which you recall we have two, we have endangered spring chinook and threatened steelhead, but also the diversity in the other species that they operate at their hatchery. Do they have one species? Do they have five different species? And then finally, we identified our desire to have the ability to influence the biological outcomes of what's produced at our hatchery facility. So that's the district's ability to influence those outcomes. So I want to talk a second about what do we mean by fish quality? And ultimately, it comes down to four main things. The first thing is the size of the fish at release. So this is size it released from our hatchery or acclimation facility as those fish enter the river. The next is fish uniformity. So making sure our fish are the same size. So, for instance, the big fish aren't getting so big that they're eating all the food, and the small fish aren't getting any food. We want to ensure that all fish are very uniform in size to preclude that from happening. We look at the quality of the fins of the fish. This is basically, we want to ensure that biologically these fish can be the best they can be once they get into the river. And we want to ensure that the fish are pathogen-free. So this has to do with how clean the rearing vessels are, the best management practices the operator has in terms of ensuring proper cleanliness, water distribution, and that fish health has been consulted along the way. So next I'll talk a little bit about the results of that evaluation. We had multiple alternatives we identified. The top three options in ranking all of those criteria were a private contractor to conduct the work. And it should be noted that we are generally talking about a private contractor. We would certainly have a lot of work to do to go out and determine what specific contractor the market would present to us in terms of an operator. The option to self-perform the work. This means hiring full-time equivalents at the district as union employees. And DFW to continue to operate the facility. So a couple of really important things to note about those results. Our costs were roughly comparable between the district and DFW. The costs were done at a very high level, given this very high level analysis, but can be best summarized by a couple of things. We primarily use the same number of FTEs between DFW and the district. What this means is that We have budgets every year that DFW proposes, and they have a certain number of FTEs to conduct the work. What we haven't yet done is evaluate whether that staffing could be optimized based on our own expectations and our own union rules that would apply. So for ease of comparison, we use the same number of FTEs, which to note is roughly 19 to 21 full-time equivalents. And ultimately, the cost came out that the DFW's total cost, they have a relatively low labor wage as compared to the district. But when you add on their loaded rates of around 43%, and then you multiply that times the indirect rate that we see, it's that variable rate that the district is charged every year on the order of around 30%. When you take that number and then you compare it to the district wages, which are a little bit higher at the offset, but when you add on our 70%, which gets us, or roughly 74%, which gets us to our burden rate, turns out the cost is essentially a wash between the two. So what the analysis did highlight, the second point, is that fish quality is not optimal. We need to better influence our biological outcomes. So we need to be able to get to higher quality fish, which ultimately leads to better fish performance in out through the hydro system and then hopefully back as adults. So for the next steps for this particular analysis, staff believe that focusing on improving our fish quality and communication with DFW over the next year is imperative. So what we're proposing to do is we're going to sit down with DFW to develop a quality control plan with measurable outcomes to continue evaluating their effectiveness to continue as the district's hatchery operator. We anticipate this plan to continue or to contain such things as specific feeding schedules, in hatchery, transfer dates, temperatures, all of the things that are necessary to be able to document a program from, you know, the first incubation to the release of adults that will let us know that DFW is committed to making fish husbandry changes, and they can maintain that process through the whole fish life cycle as long as it's in our hatchery. So we're planning to meet with them, the local program manager for fisheries and the East Bank complex manager in the beginning of December to formally request this plan and to work out a schedule for delivery. So at this point, it's staff's recommendation that we execute a contract amendment with DFW for a year for 2021. We hope to come back to the board on December 7th to request that amendment. And as a little preview, the proposed budget increase for 2021 is actually 1.15% less compared to 2020. This is primarily because we have eliminated some of the chemicals we've been budgeting for our acclimation facilities for fish outbreaks that we just have not used over the years. So this also exemplifies the dynamic nature of these budgets from year to year in the hatchery arena. So the next thing I'd like to go on and talk about is the hatchery monitoring and evaluation. So at the same board meeting in November 18, 2019, you also directed staff to evaluate the alternative contracting opportunities to conduct the monitoring evaluation activities. We want to continue to receive quality results while paying a fair and reasonable price for services. Now, for the 2020 budget, the costs weren't as large of an increase as they were for hatchery operations, but they were on an increase about 4.5%. That was primarily due to, again, that indirect rate increase and some COLA adjustments that were made to staff. So we used similar criteria as we identified for the hatchery operations analysis. Ultimately, the goal would be to provide a cost-effective solution for the district and then result in collecting quality data in an efficient manner to inform our hatchery program. Again, the reason for our hatchery monitoring evaluation program is a direct requirement of habitat conservation plans for both Rocky Reach and Rock Island, that we have to continually measure the effectiveness of the hatchery fish as compared to, in some instances, the natural fish in the environment. So I thought it prudent to, because the hatchery monitoring evaluation is a very different sort of beast at the district, I wanted to give just a brief history of the M&E contractor selection process. So prior to 2014, DFW actually conducted a majority of the M&E tasks for the district. And if you could go on to the next slide, Rebecca. In 2014, we restructured our M&E program through the Rock Island and Rocky Beach Hatchery committees. And subsequently, we put out a request for proposals to really determine what the market would provide to do the work. What we found was not a tremendous amount of interest to conduct such a large-scale program where, frankly, DFW had been conducting it for decades at this point. So what we started to do was kind of peel away specific tasks that we thought we could either find a different contractor to do or to self-perform. So one of those examples is in that same year, we elected to conduct our own spring Chinook surveys in the river instead of DFW, in part due to the cost that they were proposing for that service and the importance of the data for that particular ESA listed fish. These are our endangered spring Chinook in the upper basin. So some additional history about how we make changes to contractors. Similarly, in 2019, the district elected to take in-house the in-hatchery pre-release sampling due to high costs proposed from DFW. We thought that this was something easy to peel off and do ourselves. And then in 2020, we elected a contract with BioAnalyst, who's another one of our hatchery M&E contractors, to conduct steelhead pit tagging at the off-ladder sampling facility owned by Grant PD due to the high proposed costs from DFW. So the take-home of this is that for hatchery M&E, primarily it's the methodology that drives the contractor selection. And switching among contractors, as long as we can develop a clear methodology and it's a very distinct task, is actually relatively easy for us to do. So the results of this analysis that we did, again, we used similar criteria developed for the hatchery operator analysis. What we ended up with was very comparable scores between continuing with DFW, self-performing at the district, or hiring a private contractor. Again, we don't know exactly what the market can hold for a private contractor, but based on prices we've seen elsewhere, we think that it would be comparable. So the one important thing to note is that the costs among these three options are a bit difficult to compare. The primary reason is that because DFW is a state agency, they tend to budget based on a position, whether it's a full-time or a seasonal position, which are fully funded by the district. Conversely, private contractors or district staff routinely bill hours only for a specified task. So at times, it's hard to discern between the hours to conduct a task versus the number of positions needed to conduct that task. So for a contract with this many tasks, it is a bit harder to compare apples to apples, which is why we tend to focus more on the methodology to get the data. And we are transitioning to having a more diverse contractor makeup, as you can see from the next slide, to kind of further demonstrate the breakdown of the contracts of who conducts our work. So on the left, you'll see our four high overarching M&E objectives, some of the particular subtasks in the next column. And you can see for those particular species, we do have a diverse set of folks that conduct our activities. You know, DFW roughly is about 75% of those activities, followed by bioanalysts at about 15%, and district self-performing at about 11%. So in terms of next steps, beginning in this year and continuing into next year, the district is developing a new methodology for steelhead escapement. That's to determine how many fish actually end up in the Wenatchee Basin. So our goal, frankly, is to eliminate the costly surveys conducted by DFW and to also provide a more reliable and accurate data set. We do expect to capture those efficiency gains in the 2022 budget. So again, I want to reiterate that we continue to evaluate methodologies for specific tasks and the appropriate entity to conduct those activities. And with this, we are going to recommend that we execute a contract amendment with DFW for 2021. Again, we propose to come to the board December 7th. And that this particular budget proposal for 2020 includes roughly a 4.3% increase, which is due in part to a COLA adjustment, and then due to some state HR requirements that we have to convert seasonal positions to career seasonal positions, which adds additional months for some workers' compensation on some HR-related fields. And when we come back in December 7th, we'll be able to better describe what those increases are. So with that, before I turn it over to Thad to discuss our adult fish returns at Rock Island, wanted to give you an opportunity to ask any questions about any of that before I turn it over to Thad.
Hi. Good job. Yeah, so we'll hear more about the contract amendment on December 7th.
Yes, that is my intent.
Okay, then I'll wait. I'll wait for that. Thank you.
Okay.
Elaine, Gary Arsenault here. I have a question with respect to the 4.3% increase. Can you tell me the dollar amount that reflects?
I cannot off the top of my head. I think that's probably somewhere around maybe $60,000, but I can certainly get back to you, and we'll have that number for sure in more specificity in December 7th.
Great. Thank you. I'll hold that question until the next meeting, but that'd be great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Arlene, this is Steve McKenna. I have two questions. The seasonal versus contract employees, why does that impact us if we're contracting those services out? Is that just a pass-through to us?
Are you referring to the 4.3% increase for this year?
Right.
So the way I understand it is it's a HR requirement, essentially how the state administers their positions, and there was a state requirement to convert seasonal positions to career seasonal positions, which translates to additional months for both workers' compensation and health insurance. So it pretty much is a pass-through. It doesn't actually increase the level of effort expended on our tasks. It's part of that burdened wage rate.
Okay. And then I'm always curious about indirect costs when we contract work out, trying to balance off, you know, we might pay a higher wage for an employee but not pay those indirect costs. What is the indirect, do you know off the top of your head? I know it's kind of an unfair question, but what we're being charged for indirect costs for the department?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things. So there is a DFW has a particular wage rate for their particular union position. On top of that wage rate, there is about a 43% sort of what we call a loaded wage rate. On top of that, and that's very similar to what we do, that's all the things that, you know, retirement and things like that, to have an employee. What's on top of that is roughly the anywhere between 28 and 35% annually that DFW charges us and some of their other contractors they do indirect, they do work with as an indirect rate. So that includes things like tech support, building rentals, all of the functions that DFW has sort of in its Olympianship to be able to have those employees work for us under contract.
Okay. And is that indirect rate staying pretty stable or?
No, not always. It actually bumps from year to year. So that rate is actually set by the department. It's proposed by the state to the Department of Interior, and they actually approve the rate that the state can charge folks for contracting their services. We have seen that rate as low as, I want to say, about 26% several years ago to as high as almost 35% a year or two ago. And that's part of one of the things we've talked about in the past is that the frankly, our inability to either predict what that rate's going to be and or control that rate is difficult because on a, say, $3 million contract, the difference of 5% can matter quite a bit.
Thank you. I just find that to be one of the key factors in determining whether you continue with a contract or not if that indirect rate isn't controlled. So it's something that I like to look at anyway. Thank you.
So if there's any other questions, we'll go on to the fish counts for 2020, Thad.
Thanks, Helene. Hello, everybody. The adult fish returns for 2020 were positive overall, thanks to the returns of summer Chinook, sockeye, and coho. Spring Chinook were down again this year. The counts were down about around 7,600 fish compared to around 8,800 last year, with a 10-year average of around 17,000. And the percent of the 10-year average at Rock Island for that 2020 count was 44%. For Bonneville, it was 39%. As I mentioned, the summer Chinook did quite well. In fact, they actually opened the fishery and made a lot of anglers happy this year. We had around 71,000 summer Chinook this year, and the run is completed. Around 41,000 last year with a 10-year average of around 59,000. And that represents the percent of the 10-year average is represented by that count is 119% at Rock Island and 91% at Bonneville. The fall Chinook count is still ongoing. As of the 18th of October, we had around 12,000 at Rock Island compared to 11,000 last year, so we're kind of on track, a little higher this year, with a 10-year average of around 15,000 fall Chinook. Same with the steelhead, the run is ongoing. As of the 18th of October, we had about 6,700 steelhead, a little bit better than last year, at around 4,000, with a 10-year average of around 8,900 fish. Sockeye was another run, or another species that performed well. Again, they opened the fishery for sockeye, and a lot of anglers had success catching them this year. 280,000 sockeye this year at Rock Island compared to, it says 50,000 there. That's actually the Rocky Reach count. The Rock Island count for 2019 was around 59,000. And the 10-year average shown there is actually Rocky Reach. Rocky Reach's 10-year average. The actual 10-year average for Rock Island is 250,000 sockeye, which translates into the percent of the 10-year average for that count for Rock Island is 112% for 2020. And in Bonneville, it remains 111%. Coho is another species that's ongoing, or another species that's currently migrating through both projects. Again, they performed very well this year, are performing very well, to the surprise of a lot of people. Around 27,000 this year so far at Rock Island, around 10,000 last year, and with a 10-year average of around 11,000. Lamprey, we're down this year. We had 480 at Rock Island. In addition to that, Grant PUD trapped 354 lamprey at Priest Rapids, and Douglas County PUD translocated them upstream of Wells Dam. So if you add those fish into the 480 that we counted at Rock Island, we have 834 lamprey that we will receive credit for passage at Rock Island. Compared to last year, we counted 1,067 at Rock Island, but when you add in the translocated fish last year, it was around 1,300 total we received credit for at Rock Island. With a 10-year average around 3,900 fish, which represents the percent of the 10-year average for that 2020 count without the translocated fish is 12%. If you add in the translocated fish, it jumps up to 21%. And Bonneville is their lamprey count for 2020, the percent of the 10-year average is 34%. Bull trout, we had 20 fish at Rock Island this year, 24 last year. The 10-year average is 56, not 60. And the percent of the 10-year average for that count of bull trout is 36%. So overall, like I said, it was a positive year for the most part. The summer Chinook and sockeye and coho. Spring Chinook were down a little bit. I think that could be contributed to what researchers NOAA and WDFW called the blob, which was basically a heat wave in the ocean, which came about in 2013 and lasted until 2016. And resulted in the mortality of a lot of seabirds and salmon, and also that warmer ocean water is very nutrient poor, so potentially the young salmon weren't getting the nutrition they needed to grow and to get the size they needed and survive. Plus, it brought in predators that aren't normally seen off the coast of Washington and Oregon, like mackerel and rockfish, a huge number of rockfish. Unfortunately, there was an article in Forbes magazine, that said that this another heat wave is setting up in the ocean as of September 2019. And they said in the article that a bundle of warm water stretching from Alaska to Mexico has formed and already ranks as the second largest marine heat wave in the northern Pacific Ocean in the last 40 years. So it could be, might be kind of rough on the salmon. Yet for a while. We don't know yet as far as returns. Chinook, anyway. I think that about covers it. If there are any questions.
Fab, this is Dennis. Does there seem to be a reason why some of the species are doing exceptionally well? You know, you covered, I think, the heat in the ocean, you know, and some causes for maybe some declines. So what are some of the things that are causing some of the runs to be stronger?
That's a good question. I was thinking about that. The only thing I can speculate about with spring Chinook, I looked up what the life cycle of the sea lions there that are below Bonneville, and their breeding season is January through March. And after March, the male sea lions head out and look for food. So I don't know if the spring chinook, that's just about the time the spring chinook are moving through Bonneville. I don't know if, I'm just speculating that if the male sea lions are really hungry, that they're getting a mouth on anything they can below Bonneville. That may be why the spring chinook are so much more affected than the other chinook species. I'm not sure why summer chinook and fall chinook don't seem to be as affected as spring chinook, although the fall chinook are a little lower than the 10-year average.
Yeah.
As far as lamprey go, you know, they're kind of an enigma. Nobody really knows. There's a lot of studies going on with lamprey, and, you know, 2017 we had 20,000 lamprey at Rock Island, and now this year we had 480. So I don't know what's going on with the lamprey. They don't home back to their natal streams. They key in on the scents that are given off by juvenile lamprey, and when they find those juvenile lamprey, they'll spawn wherever they're at. So they're not loyal to their native stream by any stretch of the imagination. Why the lamprey are down? What's going on? I know that they had issues in the lower river with passage. You know, John Day and McNary was lamprey this year. And lamprey, they can reside in the fresh water for a year before they spawn. Some reside in the fresh water for 2 years before they spawn.
Yes.
They're a difficult fish to kind of figure out.
They're interesting to begin with. So why are the, as an example, the sockeye showing an increase?
You know, that's a good question. Some years it's just a bumper crop of sockeye, and some years it isn't. I don't know why. Aline may have.
Hey, Santa. Yeah, I can help out here if folks can hear me. I think I'm having problems with my mic.
We can hear you, Aline.
Oh, great. Okay, so. Two really important things to note. So both the coho program and the sockeye program have really great hatchery programs. So the coho program, this was actually a program that the district is invested a lot of time and effort and finances to for the last 15 years. And this these last couple of years, the Yakima Nation, they're the ones that administer this program. For the Upper Columbia, they have finally gone to their full production of coho smolts. And so those fish tend to return really on an annual basis. So the more hatchery fish they release, the more likely they are to return, because they're one-year-old fish when they 1 year old in the ocean, if they have huge smolt releases, a lot of those fish can come back because they are less afflicted by ocean conditions for as long. So that's why we're seeing those tremendous coho numbers. Also, the sockeye, we also have a really great hatchery program with the, as you're well aware, with the Okanagan Nation Alliance up in Penticton. And so we contribute with Grant PUD entirely to that hatchery program. And over the last several years, we've seen a really fantastic ability to have those adults in the hatchery, and so have been able to put out a lot of fish. So we're attributing a lot of those fish to the Okanagan Nation Alliance hatchery program.
Okay, thank you.
So that concludes our presentation for the Fish and Wildlife Update.
Thank you, Aline and Thad. And commissioners, we are moving towards giving you these updates on fish runs because we think it just creates situational awareness for you about what's going on out there. And we are looking at, in particular, the spring Chinook question and maybe bringing you back some more information about that as we're able to evaluate some of the new data that's been made available to the public this year. With that, I'd like to turn to the customer and stakeholder feedback agenda item. I think we'll be starting with John Stoll today.
Yes, thanks, Steve. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. Commissioners, you may recall in the summer we had our survey, and you got the results from that survey, as well as some customer feedback. We really kind of broke that into two parts because at the very last question of that survey was just kind of an open-ended, is there something customers would want to let us know? We had several hundred comments around that, so we took some time to dig into that and prepare a report, and so here we are today. Along with that, I know we'll break this into two parts. Justin Erickson will also talk about the recent stakeholder feedback survey. So back to the next slide. So again, why we're here is to review those responses. As I mentioned, we had a good response rate from the customers who answered that question. We had dozens of really positive comments around appreciating the low rates, the service, things of that nature. But what we really wanted to focus on was kind of the key themes that came out of that, and specifically where we had action items addressing those concerns. So the top three had to do with rates, primarily electric, fiber expansion, as well as technology improvements. Next slide. So I just wanted to address each one of those. The first one was rates. And frankly, when looking at those comments, it was determined we could probably do a little bit more on outreach, our communication plan around the rate process. So I know Justin and Neil in communications and working with Steve have identified some strategies. One is just, you know, what we've heard from our customers over the years is that the majority of our customers like smaller annual rate increases as opposed to deferring them and then having a larger one later in the future. Also, the opportunity to, again, focus that Chelan PUD has some of the lowest electric rates in the nation. Putting that in context so they can see how that stacks up when you look at it, not only from the energy charge, but also the base charge as well, and how that compares to inflation. We heard this in strategic planning, but taking advantage of multiple communication channels. I know we get a lot of feedback on the customer newsletter, but what else can we provide via the web, press releases, social media, things of that nature? And again, we will continue that as we close out the year through 2020. Next slide. Fiber expansion. Certainly that was on our customers' mind, wanting to know where that stood, requesting the continued expansion of the project. So our responses are certainly that has been identified as a top priority. The Board of Commission agreed to funding the acceleration of the expansion with the goal of completing the majority of the build-out by the end of 2024. With that goal in mind, we also looked internally and came up with a strategy to reorganize the fiber operations group with the customer utilities, really the distribution group, to really work together to leverage resources to support that acceleration and meet that expansion goal. And as the strategic plan states, ultimately, the PUD's public power benefit program will provide 85 to 90% fiber access to the high-speed broadband by the end of 2026. Next slide, Rebecca. And then the third one was technology improvements. We heard comments around just better website access. What can we do to improve information for customers? So certainly this past year, we've spent a lot of time on the district technology roadmaps. They are really the core foundation for things that we put in motion over the next 5 years, really bolstering up what we have from a technology really aimed at customer enhancements and providing value to them. This year in 2020, we installed the new CIS, or the Customer Information System. That is really what we needed to do to support many of these technologies, but primarily the advanced metering project that really will deliver on those customer benefits. Outage alerts is an example, high bill alerts, more customer usage information, how that will support conservation and energy efficiency programs, as well as an improved customer portal for accessing information, as well as doing business with the district. I'm going to turn it over to Justin at this point.
All right. Thank you, John. Good morning again, commissioners. This final slide here just provides some summary information about our additional outreach that we've done on our stakeholder survey. As you know, we conducted that survey back in March with our consultant that we work with, Burke Consulting. And that process involved 52 external stakeholder interviews. There were some internal interviews as well, but 52 external stakeholders. you've seen that survey and those results previously, and what we've done since that last engagement with and discussion with you is we've looked through those 52 responses and identified where there was, you know, a particular gap in scores compared to the average, or some comments that were left in the narrative piece where we wanted to connect and reach back out again with some of those specific stakeholders. So roughly, I think around half of those 52 stakeholders we've been able to connect with again in the last couple of months. Some of the common themes that we've heard in the initial effort and in the reconnection were an appreciation for the district's openness, the fact that we do engagements like this and surveys like this, our willingness to partner. Many stakeholders also requested even more engagement and communication, district participation in agency meetings and activities, and increased coordination. So we're being very receptive to those requests. We're continuing to seek meaningful engagement. I know this is filtering through throughout the organization with different staff members that may interact with stakeholders at various opportunities. And so really look forward to continuing to strengthen these important relationships going forward. And with that, John and I would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Commissioners, would note too that you have an addendum there, an appendix that includes a lot more of the detail behind the customer feedback, each managing director who the issue was assigned to, kind of work through that and put their response in that table.
Commissioners, we were just providing this as information for you today. Wasn't necessarily expecting any questions, so I think we're going to jump ahead to the next item, and that would be the McKenzie Beverly permit. Steve Wickel is going to present for us today.
All right, I'm going to try that one more time. Good morning, commissioners. This is Steve Wickel in Transmission Engineering. Can everybody hear me?
Doing good, Steve.
Okay, perfect. Welcome, everybody. I'm here to present on the McKenzie Beverly permit. It's long awaited. This is electric transmission line permit with the U.S. Forest Service for operating our 115 kV transmission line. Of note, there is no board action being requested today. This is just information to allow you to ask questions at the next board meeting and for hopeful approval of the permit. Next slide, please. So why we're here today, the district has been working with the U.S. Forest Service to reissue the special use permit for the McKenzie-Beverly transmission line, 115 kV transmission line. And the permit does require compensatory mitigation, which I'll describe in another slide. Next slide, please. Background, the permit covers two transmission lines that are in the same corridor, the McKenzie-Beverly 115 kV line, which goes from Sunny Slope clear up to Summit, and a line we call the McKenzie-Leavenworth line, also 115 kV, that goes from Sunny Slope to Peshafton. 20 miles of this transmission line cross Forest Service ownership. 6 miles are on easement that predate the Forest Service ownership, leaving 14 miles that are applicable to this permit. We've been working in earnest since 2013 to get a new permit, and for quite a number of years before that, off and on, as different players changed, both here at the PUD and at the Forest Service as well. But this is just an overall map. This is actually a cover map for the map set that's part of the permit. You can see in the lower right-hand corner is Sunny Slope, and the transmission line traverses all the way up to the left-hand side of the page, which is the Summit. The little squares 1, 2, 3 through 12 are actual areas that have Forest Service ownership. Forest Service land is actually the light green shade on this map. So this is just an informational map to let you know the area we're talking here. Next slide. So inside the permit authorizes transmission line inspection, both aerial and on ground, transmission line maintenance and repair, vegetation management in the right-of-way to include danger tree removal adjacent to the right-of-way, use and maintenance of access roads. This was really the hardest part of the permit, were the access roads and the allowed use to perform maintenance on the roads. And there's also an implemented negotiated operating plan as part of the permit. So we implemented a programmatic approach with the Forest Service when evaluating the effects for this permit. We've implemented an operating plan and included best management practices that really provide a streamlined approach to implementing maintenance by eliminating environmental permitting for each activity that we go to do along the line. We do have an annual meeting with the Forest Service to discuss upcoming planned work. This is part of the operating plan. The programmatic approach protects ESA species. ESA is the Endangered Species Act of 1973. Fish and owl are really the species of concern, and these best management practices avoid or minimize environmental impact when performing work. Compensatory mitigation. As the footnote states, it's essentially compensatory mitigation are really just actions, restoration, enhancement type actions to preserve wetlands and streams for the purpose of offsetting unavoidable adverse impacts. And it was determined that there are unavoidable effects to ESA listed fish and their habitat as part of our ongoing work. It's really related to road related sediment from the access roads and the maintenance we need to do on the roads, as well as reduced stream shade from vegetation management. So we did work collaboratively with all services to establish actions that offset the unavoidable impacts, and these are the compensatory mitigations on the next slide. So the biggest and most impactful is decommissioning 9.2 miles of road in the Nation Creek watershed. We've worked on a draft interlocal agreement with Chelan County Natural Resources Department, who will actually oversee and perform the work. The estimated cost is $505,000. We are funding that work and therefore getting credit for the benefits of that project. There's also a dispersed recreation site decommissioning we're going to do. This is up past Coles Corner on the way to Lake Wenatchee. We're going to block access to an unauthorized recreation area and replant about a third of an acre with native trees and shrubs. There's an estimated cost of $50,000 for this. And the Upper White Pine riparian restoration, this was a project we actually completed in 2018, but we did fund for replanting native vegetation along 3 acres of unused transmission corridor, and that we do get to receive credit for this project. So we expect to complete mitigation actions over the next 2 to 3 years. We're allowed up to 8 years in the agreement, and we do have funds included in the Transmission Department 2021 O&M budget. Mm-hmm.
Steve, may I jump in there? In here? It's
yes,
Ann.
Of course.
Hi. Hey, what does decommissioning 9 miles of road in Nason Creek watershed involve?
So, basically, forest engineers evaluated these areas. They were past timber harvest lands, and so it's essentially removing the roads, water bars, replanting, and allowing, of course, that native vegetation to grow back. You hydrologically block the road at the entrance so that nobody can get past it. You've probably seen these if you've gone up into the forest. They might be huge dips where they're impassable or large berms essentially to block all traffic going in. So it'll just restore the forest in the long run.
Did you say it was a logging road?
Yeah, so these are sections of forest that were, I believe, owned by Weyerhaeuser. There's two different, there's 8.2 miles of road in one area that I believe was owned by Weyerhaeuser. And then there's another 1 mile of road, and I can't remember who the ownership of that was, but we are able to fund both sections for the road decommissioning and to get credit for this.
Okay. Thank you. Great.
You bet. Next slide, please. So this is just a sample of the Upper White Pine Transmission Corridor replanting. That top left photo is just a bunch of trees and shrubs that were ready to be planted back in 2018. And you can see in the lower right-hand corner, the old corridor. You can see right there, Nason Creek meandering through there. And you can barely see the new corridor. So we went off to the north, rerouted around Nason Creek, much less impact. The there was a project to do some restoration along the channel. We didn't pay for that. And then we allowed the replanting to occur within the old corridor. So next slide, please. So in summary, we have a 30-year permit that's ready for signature. There's been years of collaboration with the Forest Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and National Marine Fisheries. We've developed a programmatic approach to the maintenance, and there's been an in-depth legal review of the terms of this permit. Environmental analysis indicates unavoidable effects to ESA-listed fish and their habitat. We've agreed on compensatory mitigation to offset the unavoidable effects to fish and fish habitat, and the estimated mitigation cost is $555,000. Next slide, please. So for next steps, we're hoping to return to the board meeting next time to answer any questions you may have. Of course, I'm here to answer questions you have now, but in case you think of more before the next board meeting. And with that, I will take any questions.
This is Gary Arsenault. I had a question. Will there be, is there the need for a new road to be constructed with respect to servicing the transmission lines?
Yes, sir. So there's approximately 2 miles of new road that are permitted in the permit. They're not really roads per se, as they're included in the permit. It's just our definition of a road and the Forest Service definition is quite different. We essentially just clear enough to get either tracked rigs or our line crew equipment in. They're generally much more narrow, maybe 15 feet wide as opposed to 25 feet wide, and we don't require all the banking and all the engineering required. So that's kind of a long answer for your question, but there is 2 miles of new access that is permitted in the permit.
And do we have a, will we have a cost estimate on what it is to build that 2 miles?
That's a great question. So the way this kind of works is we don't know if we're going to need to actually use those 2 miles of road or not. With the programmatic approach that we did, we have the ability to use that when we need to. But likely it will just be, it's really just our dozers going in and clearing out just the minimal amount of path that's needed to get access to these structures. It's not really roads like it was when we did the Dead Horse Canyon road work, where we literally did actually put in new roads. So the cost won't be like it would be for a normal road, if that answers your question.
It does. Thank you, Steve.
You bet.
Okay, not hearing any more questions. Board's aware that this will be coming back in a couple of weeks for your approval. If you have any questions before then, please let us know. We'll make sure that Steve gets them. With that, we're just a few minutes over our regularly scheduled stop time, so I would propose that Commissioner Arsenault, that we might go to lunch at this point.
Okay, that sounds good. Why don't we take a recess for lunch and begin our business session 1 hour from now. That'll be 1 o'clock. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. It is the November 2nd, 2020 business session of the Lyon County B&E Commission meeting. I'd like to thank everyone for voluntarily joining this meeting, these virtual meetings. But due to social distancing as a result of COVID-19, our meeting is conducted both by telephone and by virtual. Any public that might be on the phone and wishing to make comments or ask questions, when you do so, please state your name and address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes. I will open phone lines up later on in this afternoon business session for such comments. So, Steve, as we move forward, the first item on the agenda is item number 9. Would you like to take over?
Sure. So we take another step in our budgeting process for 2021 today, a really important step because today we begin to discuss specific numbers that for the budget proposal. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mark Mullins to make this presentation.
Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Mark Mullins, Director, Enterprise Planning, Risk, and Analytics. And I also have Deborah Vaughn on the phone. She's our strategic financial planning analyst who coordinates the budgeting process and outreach across the district regarding budgeting items and timelines to make sure that we're keeping on track to meet this objective for the year. So welcome to the first of two public hearings on the 2021 budget. So we're going to cover the timeline, initial results, and highlights, as well as our next steps. There will not be any board action required. We'll just give you a sneak preview at our preliminary numbers based on what we have at this point. So looking at the budget timeline, as you know, we went through an iterative process with the business plans that were presented to the board on October 5th. At the last board meeting, we provided an overview of our budget assumptions to kick off the budget season, and we transitioned from our five-year business planning into a one-year budget, and that occurred on the 19th of October. And we are here today on November 2nd conducting the first of two formal board public hearings, with a second occurring on November 16th. And then we'll come back to the board on December 7th, and we'll request budget approval to close out the annual process. So looking at this from a strategic focus, the 21 budget will be built around our strategic initiatives and the business plans that were presented on October 5. As you know, the business plans were a five-year look, so this is a deeper dive into the single year, 2021. And the foundation of our strategic initiatives and budget, of course, at the top of our balanced scorecard is customer owner satisfaction. So the initiatives that we'll put forth, we'll always keep that in mind. And we also consider the district strategic plan for 2020 through 2024, where we identified four strategic goals, which are investing in assets and people, financial resilience, public power benefit, and supporting our county and economic development with consideration for stable and predictable rates. So let's first take a look at our five-year financial plan for 21 through 2025. So just to orient you to the page, the preliminary budget for 2021 is highlighted in gray, and we'll also do some comparisons with our 21 through 2025 business plans. So from our preliminary budget for 21, our bottom line is forecasted to be at $55 million. This is really consistent with our 21 through 2025 business plan for the time period of 2021. I would note that this is $13 million over our 2020 forecast at budget last year for 2021. And there's a couple drivers for that. One is the admin fees associated with the selling Alcoa surplus proceeds on their behalf. That's one item that we only budget for 1 year at a time. Depreciation is lower, and then we also have the benefit of the debt premium amortization to round out the differences between the forecast at last year's budget versus where we're at today. And looking at from a broader perspective in the five-year window, 2021 through 2025, Comparing that to last year's forecast at budget adoption, we are down about $13 million over the five-year window. And there are a lot of moving parts in all of these categories, obviously, but if we can generally boil it down to there certainly has been a price decrease in the Mid-Sea wholesale prices, and we're seeing some of those impacts with respect to lower revenues, particularly out in 24 and 25, where we're less hedged in that window based on our hedging program. So as part of our budgeting process, we are required to bring forth a five-year look as well as an annual budget that meets our financial policy metrics. And you'll see before you the four financial policy metrics that we report on a quarterly basis and also through the budget process. We are meeting all of our financial policy metrics during this time period over the five-year horizon. I would note on liquidity, we are seeing a liquidity requirement ranging from $180 to $210 million over the five-year period. And that's due to a methodology that we set forth with really looks for looks at our operating planning and contingency reserves and what those requirements are. So we are just wanted to mention that our liquidity requirement in 2025 is $207 million. On the combined debt service, the debt service coverage, we have a range of 2.08 to 3.06 over the five-year window. This is meeting our target of greater than 2.0. I would note the 2.08 is in 2022. I had mentioned this morning. There are some drivers for that. The reason it's highlighted here is it is within 10% of our financial policies, so just wanted to note that. The large units at Rocky Reach, we've moved those expenditures out into 2022 and 2023 primarily. So it is pushing our combined cover in that year a little bit lower, but we are noting here that we are meeting it. We're just within the 10%. And then I'd also like to note that as we move through time to 23 and 24, that metric increases to 2.93 and 3.06. Debt ratio less than 19% in 2025. This compared to a target of less than 35%, which was our target for 2019 that we actually met 1 year early, as well as our days cash on hand being greater than 250 days for this five-year time horizon. So moving on to our combined financials for 2021, I do want to note one change that might be different than the materials that you received on Thursday. In the far right-hand column, you'll see a percent change. Those were reviewed once again, and we identified a formulaic error in the calculation, so we just wanted to fine-tune those for the final presentation. What you're seeing on the screen includes those revisions, but just wanted to make note of that in case you were looking at some old materials.
And board members, if you are looking at that in your board effects package, you would have needed to refresh that this morning in order to make sure you get the same numbers on that percentage change column.
Thank you, Steve. So looking at our combined financials for 2021, preliminary budget for 21 versus the adopted budget for 2020. So you'll see our bottom line of $55 million. This is slightly below our adopted budget for 2020 of $58 million. So there are, certainly this is consistent with our 21 through 2025 plan. I won't go through these individual categories on this particular slide because we do have each of these categories in the forward slides coming, so I'll get into a little bit more detail there. But I would note on the service revenue, net surplus energy revenue, and other operating revenue, overall, there's some offsetting factors, and they're relatively flat when you compare the two budgets side by side. I would note our operating expenses from an O&M perspective is up about $6 million. This is in support of improving our hydro capability as well as distribution reliability. And then also non-operating income has some benefits associated there with our debt premium amortization for 2021. And overall, the expenditures from a net perspective is up about 1% overall. So looking specifically at service revenue, Our service revenue for the 2021 preliminary budget is $96.6 million, up about $6 million from last year, and very consistent with our business plans that we brought forth earlier in the year. From a variance perspective, looking at a couple of different things, from an organic growth on the electric side, we are seeing some offsetting impacts from our energy conservation efforts. I would note we have our off-system end-use sale that's continuing on in 2021, and we do have a $2 million benefit in this revenue category. The offset is that is in the net wholesale revenue category, as we do have that revenue transfers from a wholesale bucket over to the service revenue bucket. So I would note the prices are up slightly from that perspective, so we are showing a slight benefit in that category. The HDL electric / cryptocurrency category, that is primarily the Diamond Foundry that we're seeing that impact. We are seeing the Diamond Foundry in 2020 is slightly lagging, but this is a budget versus budget perspective, so we do see some moderate growth or slight growth with the Diamond Foundry going into 2021. I'd also like to note from a rate increase, so in the 2020 budget, we assumed rate increases would be applied in January 1st of 2021. The reason we did that is there was some uncertainty with the customer information system and when that would be available to make those changes. Through the course of time, we shifted gears and we recommended we adopt those on 6-1 of 2020, and then COVID-19. Of course, happened, and we deferred those out to 12-1 of 2020, which is what our current plan is. And then for the 2021 budget, you will see rate increases occurring on 6-1 of 21, and that would include a 3% rate increase on the electric business, 3% on fiber, and 4% for both water and wastewater. On the net surplus energy revenue, about $210.6 million in our preliminary budget. This does include both our net wholesale business and our hydro long-term contract. So this is down about $6 million in comparison. It is real consistent with our 21 through 25 business plan. However, you will see some variability just because of the impacts of the Mid-Sea wholesale prices. I would like to note overall, the net wholesale revenue is down about $5.5 million. We do see some of the offsets that I mentioned on our end-use energy sale, and we are seeing some benefits in our slice contracts associated with, in that rolling program, we typically have one slice roll off and one come on through that program. So we are seeing a higher priced slice starting in 2021 and a lower priced slice rolling off in that same time period. So we are seeing a benefit from that perspective.
Question.
Yes.
I'm looking at the Nine Canyons and other PP, whatever the PP is, showing a net loss both years. We've had Nine Canyons for 20 years now. Is it going to be a consistent loser even after depreciation is all gone and everything?
I don't have that information handy. We are recognizing the depreciation over the life of that contract, but that might be an action item I'd have to get back to you on.
I'd appreciate it because we've had it a long time.
Yes. Yep, exactly. And I'd have to look at the longer term perspective to see how that plays out over the course of time. But what we're showing here specifically for 2021, yes, is that number that you're seeing in front of you right there. But is consistent with the 2020 budget. We can take that way as an action item.
I'd love to get a little more information, yes. Thank you.
And the other PP, did you say no, the other PP is other power purchases?
Okay.
If I could just jump in and Mark, on your takeaway, if you wouldn't mind going back, as Randy pointed out, we've had it for nearly 20 years, and creating a summary for me, I would appreciate that.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
We'll put something together on that.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, this is Ann. I'm interested too because it didn't used to look this way. I suspect it's other purchases. But yeah,
It'll be interesting to see that. Thanks.
Very good. Thank you. We'll take that away as an action item. Bring that forward. Any other questions on this slide? All right, moving to the next slide on other operating revenue. This, for the 2021 preliminary budget, we're estimating, at least from our preliminary perspective, $23.8 million. I would note that we do have a cost-based contract on the transmission side, so we do have full cost recovery. As we see an increase in those investments for operations and compliance purposes, we do have that cost recovered through revenue. So as costs go up, revenue goes up as well. And you're seeing that reflected here with this first line item. I would also note frequency response revenue is down slightly, but everything else is really consistent with budget. And overall, between 2020 and a grand total versus 2021, very consistent and also consistent with our business plan. So highlighting some of our major O&M activities to support all of the business planning materials and focusing in on 2021 specifically. Looking at Rocky Reach, the turbine repairs to support our goal of improving hydro capability. So this one has shifted a little bit where the focus previously had been on the large units, C10 and C11 in particular. And however, we've shifted some of that work. We've moved some of the work for those out to 22 and 23 primarily. There will be some O&M items as we continue to look at the water-filled turbines in 21. However, the bulk of the work is moving out just so we can continue focusing on the smaller units. We've had some trunnion bushing issues that have popped up and we've been dealing with over the course of this year and also some trunnion seals. So that's included in that $5.6 million that you see there as a primary focus for Rocky Reach O&M. The hatcheries, those are $6 million. This is down about $0.7 million, $700,000 from last year. And this is our operational contracts to operate the hatcheries. On the tree trimming, $3.5 million in our O&M budget. This does include a lot more than just the tree trimming. It's really focuses on our vegetation management program. This is up about $1.4 million versus 2020. We have some efforts certainly focusing going forward to improve our distribution reliability and a lot of focus on vegetation management, and we're moving towards meeting a standard, the International Wildland Urban Interface Code. So we have a lot of work ahead of us in that area. It supports certainly the reliability metric, but it helps us with wildfire mitigation risk as well. The Rock Island Spillway Pier Repair, this is to relieve some pressure on the expansion joints as the dam continues to age. We are putting restrictions on the gantry cranes over the spots where we're identifying those issues and also restricting some operational loads as well. $2.6 million budgeted for that in 2021. Also unique to 2021 is the Rock Island HCP check-in for 2021, so we'll include some fish passage studies as well, $1.5 million. So looking specifically at the numbers, and I'll go through these quickly, this will cover the next two slides. Hydro O&M is down slightly. As I mentioned, we're pushing out the large unit repairs, primarily out to 22 and 23, where we'll see a bulk of those expenditures, where previously we had planned for those in the 2020 budget. Hydro Fish and Wildlife, we have the HCP 10-year check-in. So we do see the studies that we're going to be doing for fish passage. Hydro's Parks and Recreation, slightly down as compared to the 2020 budget. As we did in 2020, we had some Discovery Center work, electrical work, plumbing work. We had the museum move. So some of those items are reflected in the 2020 as opposed to 2021. So you're seeing a slight decrease there. As mentioned, our expanded tree trimming contracts, along with vegetation management, increasing the budget slightly on the electric distribution side. And moving on to the bottom line, I'd like to also note we have increased expenditures, not overall increased expenditures, just from a timing perspective of when we're recognizing those to support the public power benefit, fiber acceleration, and some of the work that we have to do there. Continuing on with our operating expenses, we have the CIS project in 2020 that's impacting that first line item around customer service. So 2021 is slightly lower. The conservation is up about $1 million, but that's not an indication of significantly increasing our conservation efforts, but it's just a recognition of the investments over time. I would note, and as was presented to the board in June of 2020, we did see some changes in the insurance market, particularly around property and liability insurance, especially with the high visibility to wildfire risk in the West. So we did see some significant changes in premiums last year on the increases, and we're planning for that as well by incorporating that into the 2021 budget. And hopefully we'll be able to, through the work of Ron Gibbs, continue to have some good luck in that effort in terms of managing our premiums from a property and liability insurance perspective. But that's really contingent on the market, so there is a lot of uncertainty there. But we are planning on an increase for 2021. Also on the administrative in general, as we focus on technology in our efforts to become a technology leader in the utility industry, we have some roadmap costs that are included in that, driving our budget a little bit higher in 2021 versus 2020. And I would also note that we have a labor vacancy rate decrease, which is just an indication that we're able to fill our open positions more efficiently, or at least that's the expectation for 2021. So when the open positions are not open as long, then that increases our expenses there. So overall, from an operating expense, $213.8 million, roughly $6 million higher than last year, noted by the drivers in the discussion on these two slides. It is down slightly from our 2021 through 2025 business plan. On the non-operating expense, we have our investment earnings, and I reported earlier that we have a significant cash balance. However, this is a budget versus budget comparison. So when you look at that, we are continuing to draw down our cash and pay for our capital program. When you compare our budgets 2021 versus 2020, we are continuing to doing that. Lower investment earnings on lower cash balances, as well as lower interest rate assumptions for 2021 as well. I would also note the offset to that, as from an interest expense perspective, we do have some lower interest rate on our variable rate debt as well, so a benefit there. And the amortization of the debt premium is really one of the drivers here as well, giving us a lower net expense 2021 versus 2020. This is consistent with our 21 to 2025 business plan that we reported on earlier.
Quick question.
Yes.
Back on the contribution income, you didn't, I know we've gone over this before, but I can never seem to remember. What is contribution income?
So the contribution income is the contribution that we're getting to these projects.
From the purchasers?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. That's what I thought it was, but I just wanted to be sure. Thank you.
You're welcome. So looking at our 2021 major capital projects, we have a couple of major drivers, one being Rock Island. Rock Island modernization, we're seeing some significant spending. I'm noting here, B1, really the entirety of the Rock Island Dam, Powerhouse 1, B1 through B4, $16 million allocated for 2021. B5, B7, and B8, $12 million allocated for 2021. And the Powerhouse 2, U1 through U8, $18 million targeted for 2021. I would note where we're on B1 through B4 and the B5 through 7 and 8, we are noting a total project budget here. For U1 through U8, it's a little bit different because we're still in the process of negotiating those contracts. So what we're looking for here from a budget perspective is really the preliminary work associated with design and mobilization to ensure we have the buildings and the tools ready to go for that particular project. So a little bit different in, between the other two projects than what we're seeking from a budget perspective. We also have significant work, Powerhouse 2, bridge, and gantry cranes, as well as the gantry crane on Powerhouse 1, so $15 million associated with crane projects in 2021. So our other major driver on major capital projects that you're familiar with are the facilities. Significant work at Rock Island, Rocky Reach, as well as a new operations and service center. So Rock Island facilities, we are projecting $6 million for 2021. That is expected, based on current schedules, to be completed mid this year. Rocky Reach and Central Maintenance, $22 million associated with that project for 2021. This is expected to carry forward into 22 as well. $64 million associated with the Operations and Service Center. That'll kick off here significantly in 21, and then we'll continue on into 2022. Continuing on with major capital projects, Rock Island Spillway Hoist 17 and 25. This is to return those to full autogate operation, which will improve our spillway operations, reliability, and maintenance. 2.5 allocated for 2021. Also the Rocky Reach Tail Race Gantry Crane, $3 million. And the Rocky Reach Governor Controls of $1.8 million allocated for 2021. Kirk Hudson is going to speak to this project more specifically after the presentation, so I won't spend too much details on that one. Continuing on with our 21 major capital projects, the substation work I had mentioned in the quarterly presentation this morning, that we do have some work in 2020 that's getting pushed out to 2021. So we are working on substations in Wenatchee, Chelan, and Leavenworth to help support our goal of improving distribution reliability. Advanced metering infrastructure, that effort will really ramp up in 21 with $5 million allocated for 21, with the balance of that project forecasted to be spent in 22. The $15 million is the total project budget. The Chelan-Manson transmission line of $5 million, as well as the fiber expansion of $2.3 million for the public power benefit to continue that work going forward to get more fiber to more customers in our county. So looking specifically at the numbers, and we'll focus this first page on integrated electric only. And I covered most of these items in the previous slides, but just wanted to look from a perspective. Electric distribution is going up versus the 2020 budget. It's difficult to identify these as a variance necessarily because sometimes the projects continue in varying degrees of spend from one budget year to another. But from a major project focus perspective, substations, advanced metering infrastructure, our advanced distribution management system, and the Chelan-Manson transmission line are key drivers for the electric distribution budget for capital. On the electric transmission side, I would note that we do have, as you see, a negative number here, so it looks like a significant decline. However, there was a reclassification from our capital budget over to regulatory asset for two major projects, which is the North Smith Sea transmission project and also Greater McNeil Canyon, where we don't own those assets, but we are participating in those. So there's a different accounting treatment for those. You'll see an offset to those on the next slide. This slide is, don't go to the next slide quite yet. Thank you. Sorry about that. Rock Island Hydro, you can see the significant amount of spend in 2020, nearly $80 million, and pushing $60 million for the 2021 budget. So significant amount of work. Powerhouse 1, and then kicking off the Powerhouse 2 modernization as well. The cranes that I mentioned earlier associated with Rock Island, Spillway Hoist, and Rock Island facilities are all key drivers for the 2021 budget for Rock Island. I would also note the corporate shared assets, Operations and Service Center, Rocky Reach Central Maintenance Facilities, are key drivers for that budget. So from an integrated electric perspective, a capital budget of $183 million, about $20 million higher than what we saw last year for these categories. Continuing on the fiber side, although we are continuing with the public power benefit expansion and now acceleration in 2021, 2020 did include some core network equipment upgrades, so 2020 was a little bit elevated, so that's driving the variance there. And I would note that we are starting up the Dryden wastewater upgrade start as a driver there. If you look down to closer to the bottom line, you'll see regulatory assets and other. You'll see an increase of $5.7 million. That's where the Greater McNeil Canyon and the North Mid-Sea Transmission Project, that's where those are located now, and that's where we will be reporting those going forward due to that reclassification that I had pointed out earlier. So from a net capital and regulatory assets for 2021 in the preliminary budget, $195.5 million versus $170 last year. This is about a 15% increase. It is consistent with our business plan materials that we brought forth, but certainly a significant increase over the adopted budget for 2020. So on this page, it's highlighting a couple of our key capital project revisions for existing projects, and this includes revisions that are greater than $1 million to create awareness for the board. This does exclude the public power benefit and any recurring annual capital project activity. So I'll touch on these briefly. The Rock Island Powerhouse 2 rehabilitation, modernization. We are adding scope for 2021, revising from our current budget, which you see in this first column, revising it to $26 million. So this is a $14 million change. Like I mentioned before, this is not the total project budget because that's a contract still under negotiations, but this is for the 2021 project scope related to design and mobilization. The advanced metering infrastructure, revising our current budget up by $13.5 million to a total project budget of $15 million. The operations and service center increasing by $4.5 million from our current budget. This is just an update on the project estimate. Related to some expanded space that were needed. The Rocky Reach, C1 through C11, governor controls. This is an updated project estimate as well. This is the $7.6 million revision that I was referring to. And as mentioned, Kirk Hudson will provide more details on this particular project at the end of the presentation. Also noting here, Rock Island Powerhouse 1 intake gantry replacement. Update increasing budget by $1.6 million. Just for the record, the $7.6 million was increased by 0.5 because that is based on our latest information and will be reflected in the total numbers on the 11/16 presentation. On this slide, it identifies the new projects that are greater than $1 million, again, excluding the public power benefit and the recurring annual capital project activity. These first four items are items that Kirk Hudson is going to provide some more details along with the governor controls following this presentation, so I won't get into specifics there. I would note we do have a $1 million budget request for a fire risk mitigation associated with conduit installs to do some undergrounding.
And I would just add on that one that that's the one that we talked about with the board in the last session. It's up in the plain area. Okay, I'm going to jump in here to take the next few pages, talk about the FTE requests for included in this budget. As we've done in the past, we are describing these in terms of the strategic initiative that we're seeking to accomplish. So on page 23, we'll be talking first of all about technology related to automated metering infrastructure. That first position, the AMI technical analyst, is one that would be in the IT area to work on the software and hardware associated with putting AMI in place, particularly dealing with the data. The meterman position, so we no longer will need meter readers, but we do still need a meterman that will take care of particularly troubleshooting issues around meters and likely to be a high level of engagement during the installation phase. Customer account specialist, because there's a lot more data that becomes available, a lot more that can be done with customers. And we will also be dealing with an opt-out component associated with AMI. We've got system support administrator, which is essentially someone that's going to be, again, there's going to be a lot of data coming in. They'll be managing that data. And then customer systems program manager is our existing new system, now existing customer information system, requires a fair amount of maintenance associated with it for it to be able to operate. And this person is responsible for making sure that we are particularly able to issue bills accurately. On the other side is technology innovation that is somewhat separate from the AMI initiative. The board is aware that we are now moving to hire a new chief technology officer. While that's a new position, it will be replacing the position that we had that was our chief information technology officer. So essentially that's a trade. Network system administrator is really focused on cybersecurity. There's just more and more patching that's required in particular to address cybersecurity. The control system engineer, you may recall from our previous technology roadmaps, that we are also looking at an automated distribution management system, which is essentially from the substation back, the ability to be able to get to more digital control and more ability to be able to manage that system remotely. So that position will focus on that, as well as supporting 2DAM independence. So we're now operating in an independent fashion, and there's a fair number of challenges associated with that. So that position will support both ADMS and 2DAM independence. You received a presentation earlier this year from Curtis Cole regarding the work that has been established here in terms of business intelligence. We are getting more and more requests from business units to create dashboard-type information for them to be able to use the data that is increasingly being produced. And so our conclusion is that we could use another person in that group that will help to be able to make us a more data-driven organization. And the senior business analyst is a limited assignment. It's really a transition for an individual who has been in a leadership position, was getting ready to retire, will move into a support position to help us with the GIS system, our geographic information system. That GIS system is foundational to many of our efforts, and it needs to be overhauled in order to be able to make it successfully create that foundation that we need for things like mobility management, as well as being able to make ADMS work. On the next page, we are kicking off relicensing. So we expect that next year will be the first big year for relicensing. We've got a couple of new positions there, one to address the recreational studies, one to address the environmental studies that have to be done to successfully put together a relicensing proposal to the FERC. The environmental tech coordinator is a position to track waste management, particularly oil waste management, to make sure that we are in compliance with all the regulations associated with waste management.
Steve?
Yes.
On the relicensing project managers,
mm-hmm.
Relicensing is going to be complete in 8 years or before.
Yep.
What type of positions will those be after that?
Well, the way we think about this is we've got some folks who likely within 8 years maybe retiring. And so this is actually, in some ways, an opportunity for us to do some succession planning, to get some folks in who have in-depth knowledge of relicensing and be able to make sure that once we get a license that we can stay in compliance with that, because there will almost certainly be new requirements that come out of a licensing process. So it's not that you get the license and you stop. You then move to an implementation phase.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. P.S. Wireman, so we have a substantial amount of work coming as we develop new substations, and our asset management and distribution system reliability is identifying an increasing level of work associated with trying to get to that top quartile for reliability. Conclusion of that group is that they really need one more wireman in order to be successful there. And in natural resources, there are three positions, although these are more temporary positions, they're seasonal as well. These are to support the Rock Island studies, HDP studies that were described earlier to you. So there's quite a few positions there. There are some offsets, though. There were four lineman positions that we had included last year that we have decided to not pursue, in part because we're going to contractors to do the make-ready work to support the fiber expansion program. And so we've pulled those positions out. I mentioned earlier that there's an offset in terms of the chief technology officer replacing a position that's existing. And then there's four of these positions that are temporary, limited-term assignment type activities. So the net of all that is that we have eight new full-time positions that are included in this budget. Any other questions about that?
Steve, this is Gary. I had a question with respect to the net impact on payroll, and maybe this is a takeaway. You and I can talk about this at some point later, of these new eight positions.
Sure. Be happy to get you some numbers about that. Various impacts, because there are varying levels of salary associated with these positions.
Sure. That'd be great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. If there are no other questions, Mark, I'm going to turn it back over to you for page 25.
Great. Thank you, Steve. So pulling everything together that you saw in the presentation from a financial perspective and looking at our combined district expenditures, you'll see our operating expenses that we talked about roughly up 2.8%, tax expense up slightly. Also, our non-operating income and expense. We do have some benefits, as I mentioned, associated with the amortization of the debt premium. But looking at really these categories here, and adding these have the more of the bottom line impact, and then adding in our net capital and regulatory assets. Total expenditures for the district for the 2021 preliminary budget, $428.5 million. This is a 6.8% increase over our 2020 adopted budget. Moving down also to our net debt principal payments, noting here $111 million that we're planning on doing, as discussed earlier in the presentation this morning, that does include $85 million that we were planning on paying down in 2020, but we chose not to maintain some additional liquidity due to COVID-19 uncertainty. So this does include that number as part of our plan for 2021, that we would be paying this down most likely in mid-2021. So that's why you're seeing such a significant number there. If we didn't have the $85 million included, and had we paid that down this year, that number would look more like $26 million. So overall, considering that, total net expenditures plus net debt reduction, $539.5 million, 22.6% increase over last year's budget. But as mentioned, that does include the $85 million that we chose not to pay down in debt in early retirements last year. So if you net that out, just for perspective, and didn't include that $85 million, the overall increase instead of 22.6 would be 3.2%, just to add that a little extra commentary there with respect to how the debt is playing out over the course of this next year, 2021. Looking at our combined financial policies, previously I showed a five-year look with respect to financial policies. This is our 2021 preliminary budget, both in the base case, our expected case, and the unusual case, where we have stress water and prices. You can see our financial liquidity is strong at $352 million versus our target. The target is greater than our minimum of 175 because of our liquidity methodology. That considers things like our operating plans and capital plans to ensure that we have the appropriate reserves, as well as informed by risk as well. The combined cover, 2.27 for 2021. The debt ratio is expected to be 24.3 in 2021. I would like to note, and mentioned previously, our debt ratio target of less than 35% was met 1 year early. In 2018, our intent was to meet that in 2019, so a good story there. Right now in 2020, we're forecasted to be at 30.1% in 2020. So just wanted to note the significant reduction from 30.1 down to less than 25% from a debt ratio perspective in this preliminary budget. And days cash on hand is strong at 468. Looking at our financial policies for the 2021 preliminary budget, looking at our fiber, water, and wastewater with respect to our operating coverage metric. This is indicating yellow only because we're within 10%, but we are meeting our target for 2021, just within 10%. From a cash reserves perspective, all the business lines are meeting their respective metrics for 2021. Debt service as a percent of revenue, the only business line that isn't meeting the metric is wastewater at 14.1% versus a less than 2.1% target. And I would like to note the relationship between the cash and the debt metric. We do have some excess cash with respect to wastewater versus the target. We did fund Peshastin with grants and low-interest loans. And we're waiting for the outcomes of Dryden as we continue to move that project forward. So we do have some decision-making, whether that's in 2021 or another year, is to be determined, but just wanted to note the relationship here that we may have opportunity to remedy that metric if we needed to, just depending on the outcome of future decisions. So just wanted to highlight that. So our next steps. We will continue to review, of course, the budget that we have at this point. We will be putting forth our October forecast as well that is going to inform the next presentation. There will be some adjustments that we will highlight in the next presentation as well regarding anything that's changed from this first preliminary budget hearing. The next second budget hearing is scheduled for November 16th. Where we'll bring back more information, and then we'll come back on the 7th of December requesting board approval for the 2021 preliminary budget. And with that, that concludes the first public hearing for the 2021 preliminary budget. I'd open it up to any questions.
I have a comment. Mark? That for the first time that I can remember, you made 45 to 50 minutes go by without me looking at my watch. that was an outstanding presentation, and I want to thank you for being so well prepared. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that feedback.
Hey, Mark, would this be a good time, this is Kirk, to go back to those other projects?
Yes, if there's no other questions, this would be a great time, Kirk.
Okay, good afternoon, Commissioners. This is Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. I did want to refer back to a couple of slides that Mark hinted at that I'd be touching base on a little more detail on some of the projects. So if you refer back to page 21 of the presentation, you'll see the second to the bottom line item in that table, the Rocky Reach C1 through 11 unit controls governor project. Wanted to just touch on, it's a pretty significant increase in the budget we're requesting, and just wanted to provide more details on it. It's certainly been a challenge of a project for us. We originally put this budget together in 2014 with the expectation that we would complete this project in 2017 as part of our overhaul outages, replacing all the governor controls. Well, you might recall the large unit repairs popped up unexpectedly during that time frame, and so we had to completely change our outage schedules. And what originally was going to take a couple years for design took 5 years as we readjusted. But the three main drivers of the cost increase here, one of them is that the project is taking much longer. Instead of being done in 2017, we expect it to be done in 2023 with our current outage schedule. And one of the key things behind that is anytime a project takes longer, costs increase as you go, just from year to year. So we've got escalation costs both on the district labor side and the contract side, and to the tune of about $1.2 million. We've also had to provide additional hardware and software. One of the things we wanted to do during the design phase was use the expertise of the supplier as part of the design. So in order to make this new equipment work with our control system, we had to purchase additional hardware and software accordingly. And then we've had additional labor, both on the engineering and craft side. Just the significant multi-year project and outages. Certainly a number of lessons learned here that we are planning to incorporate going forward, and I'll just touch on them. But one of them is that when we don't have a design complete like we didn't when we established this project budget in 2014, we need to provide higher contingency levels, knowing that things like additional hardware and software may be needed, as well as the schedule could change given unplanned outages. So certainly a contingency we're going to look at on our project estimating. One of the things that happened along the way because the design took a lot longer was we had multiple starts and stops on the design. That certainly increased the cost. So one of the things we would do in the future is complete the design, just keep pushing through, complete the design, even if we know that we're not going to provide the first replacement for a few years. That will help reduce costs. And then another item is just looking at standardization. One of the things we did for the Rocky Reach Governor Controls was customize some of the displays on the panels to meet the Rocky Reach operations needs, which are different down at Rock Island. And so we think very possible that going forward we would standardize so that we wouldn't have customization between the two plants, and that one person working at Rock Island would see similar displays at Rocky Reach. Another one is to evaluate our systems to account for labor. And what I mean specifically here is the use of Maximo and Primavera to identify the need for these multi-year projects to have the ability to show the increase in cost from year to year. And then wrapping up the last two, we want to make sure we revisit the escalation costs on other multi-year projects. We've taken a preliminary look at this thus far. We don't think it's a material impact on the forecast going forward, but still have some work to do there. And last but not least, the evaluate the cost impacts due to escalation and design changes when changing outage schedules. The one thing we're learning is that not just a matter of changing an outage schedule. You have to look at the contracts and everything else in place when those outages change to see what the cost impacts are. So a pretty significant cost increase there for those reasons. Any questions on that one before I move to some new projects?
We'd just like to say thanks to Kirk. He's representing a group of folks who have accountability for this project, me included, and he's representing just a whole bunch of folks who've worked on these lessons learned.
Okay, if we refer to page 22, those are some new projects there. I wanted to touch on the first four just to give you an idea of what these are all about. Significant amount of money there with those projects. The Rocky Reach Tail Race Gantry Crane, this was manufactured in 1958, and with the exception of the main hoist control and some of the failed components, the equipment is original with the dam. The crane is used to install or remove stop logs in the tail race, so it's used for unwatering the units as well as the fishways, so pretty significant piece of equipment. The concern is that with the original equipment that there'll be failures, and as we have all this work stacked in front of us, we could not afford to have that piece of equipment down. So we've included our lessons learned from prior crane projects and recommending the replacement as the best solution at this time. So that's the first one. Second one is Lake Chelan seismic auto closure gate. The district has evaluated its water retaining structures for updated earthquake loads and reviewed those with FERC. FERC provided input on that evaluation, and we determined the best solution for mitigating the risk is to include the capability to isolate the penstock and powerhouse from the lake during operational conditions, which what I mean by that is when there is flow running through the penstock. There's currently no means to do that, although there is a butterfly valve up toward the dam itself. It's highly unlikely that that 90-year-old valve was designed to close during operating under flow. So the recommended way to isolate this the tunnel and the powerhouse in the lake is a new fixed-wheel roller gate supported on both sides by a series of wheels, and then steel guide rails be installed to resist bearing pressure from the wheels and distribute the loads into the concrete. The other part of this project will be to replace the emergency diesel generator up at the dam that's used for the spillway gate. And project is scheduled to be completed in 2021, although it's a significant amount of work to be done in a short period of time there. Next one, and actually the next two are the common theme with the first one, which is aging equipment needing replacement or refurbishment. The Rock Island Fishway Right Bank Fish Ladder Modification is actually the fish bypass trap. Was constructed in 1980 on the Powerhouse 2 side of the dam. It collects the juvenile fish for counting, tagging, and monitoring. The trap certainly showing some significant signs of wear that would be expected over that 40-year time frame that it's been in operation. Gate seals have begun to wear, handrails are loosening, paint's peeling from the metal components, and there's some really tight spaces that the employees are being asked to work in, which are no longer sustainable with the current operations and safety measures that we have in place. So this estimate is preliminary that we have in front of you. It does not have the complete benefit of the evaluation of all the alternatives yet. And that condition assessment is wrapping up here in the next month or two. It's estimated that this work will be done. 2021 or 2022. And then last but not least, the Rock Island Powerhouse 1 station drainage modification. This is all the equipment necessary to unwater the units in Powerhouse 1 during rehabilitation and maintenance. It also manages any leaks during operations. System is made up of sump pumps, unwatering pumps, and station drainage pumps, and all the piping valves, motors, and controls. Again, the equipment is nearing the end of its useful life. One of the concerns we have that we're trying to fix in this upgrade is provide more useful operational information and data to the control room. Right now, it's very limited in what the operators see. So they see an alarm, and they pretty much have to run down and troubleshoot. Whereas if we can give them more information, we can reduce the amount of time for diagnostics, and they can do most of that in the control room. Likely this project won't be completed until 2023, so multi-year project. And any questions on any of those? Okay, I'll turn it over to Mark. Back over to Mark if there's nothing else, or to Steve.
Well, I think that concludes our presentation with respect to the 2021 budget. So we'll just ask if there are any further questions. Okay, hearing none, we will be back at the next board meeting to do an update just to the numbers. They usually don't change very much, but so we will highlight anything that's a significant change rather than going back through this presentation.
Steve, this is Gary. If I may, I would just like to make a comment, and that is that how much I deeply appreciate all the effort and all the hands that have touched this budget, and all the work and countless hours, I'm certain, that went into preparing for it, this presentation today. So I would just like to thank everyone for all of that work and hard work at that, and the excellent presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner Arsenault. And Rebecca is reminding me that it is an appropriate moment as well to just ask if there is any public comment, since this is a public hearing.
Rebecca, if you will open up whatever lines might be available for any public that could be on the line and would wish to make a comment, please, I do ask that if you do wish to make a comment, please state your name, your address, and if you'd be kind enough to please limit your comments to 3 minutes so that others who might be wishing to make comments will have time to make their voice known. So.
We don't show anyone indicating that they are coming off of mute, so I think we're going to assume that there is no public comment at this time.
Okay. Then we shall move on. Commissioners, we have before us a consent agenda. Is there a motion to accept the consent agenda?
I would move approval.
I second.
Moved and seconded. Do we have any discussion? Hearing no discussion on the consent agenda, all those in favor of approving the consent agenda, please say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. And the ayes have it.
Okay, Commissioner, since we have no resolutions today, let me turn that off. We'd like to move to manager items. I want to start with Justin Erickson. Justin has one on Tumwater Dam.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Just wanted to update you on an upcoming construction project at Tumwater Dam. We've talked about that facility several times the last couple of years, most recently in February of this year, when we talked about a bid that was out to repair the fishway. We ended up not doing that work in the late winter construction window, and so we're now in our fall work window, and that maintenance work will begin in the next week or so. Our contractor is Knight Construction. The project is $370,000, and it will reinforce and stabilize the fishway foundation with concrete. As you may recall, the fishway foundation is experiencing some undermining from erosion, and these voids need to be repaired to ensure structural stability and prevent further deterioration of the structure. The river will be temporarily diverted away from the work area, then restored when the work is complete. The work and mobilization of equipment, which includes a crane and a concrete pump truck, will necessitate the closure of the eastbound lane of Highway 2 for approximately 8 hours in the coming days as that work starts. The viewing platform that's open to the public, normally open to the public, will be closed through the duration of the project. This is a tight construction window, and we expect the project to be wrapped up next month in December. Are there any questions?
Justin, this is Gary. Are there any concerns about weather on that project?
You know, I think there's always concerns about weather, but we do think that we have a wide enough of a construction window that we can successfully do this work, even if it gets colder and snowier than an average year. So certainly is a risk, but we're remaining pretty optimistic.
We struggle with that. There's a very small window of time you can do this work because of the fish considerations, and this is the time that we're given. So we got to go try to make it work.
Okay, thank you, commissioners.
With that, I want to turn to John Stoll, who'll be providing an update, as we have been regularly, on impacts of COVID on our customers and payment of bills.
Thanks, Steve. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. Rebecca's bringing up the update. Normally, Carrie has provided this, but I volunteered to do this. She's got her hands full today. And although we don't really have any significant changes, we still felt it was appropriate to just go through what we're seeing. And I actually had a chance to learn some more information about what's going on through our Community Action Council and what they're doing with energy assistance. So I thought that'd be a good update to provide as well. So this slide right here, this is the self-notification. You've seen this before. Not seeing many customers calling. It looks like just this past month there was three. And with that, you can see that box below. If any of those customers wish to put in some sort of a payment arrangement, none of those customers have wanted to do that. So I'd say from that perspective, it's pretty much steady as it goes. Next slide. Okay, this is a slide I thought had some really good information on it. This is the energy assistance through Community Action. Commissioners, I think you're fairly familiar with this, but these are federal funds that are distributed through the state. Commerce receives them, and they distribute the funds out to local agencies. In our case, it's the Chelan-Douglas Community Action Council is the administrator of it. As you can see, since March, there's been about $156,000 that have been dispersed. That box shows you the customer count and then the average per customer. October, it's interesting. That's one of the higher months. They worked with 74 customers and did an average allocation of $275 a month. I'm going to pause there because I want to talk a little bit more about this effort. had a chance to talk to the administrator of that program at Community Action and just wanted to get their take on how it's going, how's their funding, anything changed. And they have made some changes. For instance, their guidelines for income levels used to be 125% of the federal poverty guidelines, adjusted for household size. That's been raised to 150. So that's certainly opened the door for more folks to get assistance, as well as something I believe is new that they haven't had in the past, that there can be two allocations per year. So, for example, someone would come in October when they open the program up for the new fiscal year. They'll go through their income process, and then that's based on their energy bill. Is really, and the household size is what drives that allocation. In this case, last month was $275. Once a customer uses those funds up and they still have a need for energy assistance, they can go back and reapply. And instead of doing that calculation, they're just going with a straight $500 per household. So they feel that there's a pretty good funding for that, and certainly that will definitely help our customers who need it to have that second funding as well. I did ask them, too, just about outreach. How often do they get out in the community? Do they use other agencies? How easy is it to work with them, just given the COVID restrictions? I was encouraged to hear that yes to all those. They're willing to do whatever they can. I had mentioned there may be some customers we've struggled to get a hold of that once we do, we'll do an extra effort to connect them up with Community Action to get some support. I'll stop there, see if there's any questions on that. Okay, we'll go to the next slide, Rebecca. So this slide, you've seen this before too. This is the retail revenue and past due status. The red bar on the residential side is 2020. It's stayed relatively flat over the past 3 months, a little bit of an uptick in October. Wanted to talk about this a little bit as well. I worked with Carrie and had an opportunity to just find out a little bit more who some of those customers were, maybe just look at what are the balances? Are they going up? So I really focused on what I called the customers who were over 400 in arrears and looked at just what's been going on, if I could learn something from where those accounts sit. And I came away with the conclusion that our staff is doing everything they can to get a hold of them, but some of them are just, you know, whether they don't have phone access or there's just been not much of a response. So talking through Carrie and her team about that, probably try and redouble our efforts to get a hold of them. That could be maybe a visit to the home in some cases, maybe even using some of the agencies that are out there. But we definitely want to make contact with these folks, especially since there are plenty of EAP funds out there that we could help those customers work down those balances. So that will be an effort that we'll be picking up over the next couple of weeks, again, to try and make outreach and connect with them and drive that past due status down even lower. On the commercial side, you'll notice that it's ticked up a little bit. It's up to 28,000 over the 17.5 of last month. Again, doing a review of the accounts, that seemed to be driven by one larger customer who is actively seeking to pay that down. So that balance should drop off significantly as well. Rebecca, the next slide. This one just generally just shows the customers who normally would have triggered a disconnect notice. And again, you've seen that these numbers in the red bar have been relatively flat. A little bit of a drop off from last month, so that's always a good sign. The box up there next to it on the right is the customers with active payment arrangements. Again, that's where folks come in and or give us a call and spread out whatever is past due over an arrangement that works for them, and we set it up to administer it. And that's maintained relatively flat down. Last month was 12 of those.
Hey, John, this is Gary. Can we go back to that slide, please?
So the under customer data, commercial count, 15 businesses, but only one has got an active payment arrangement. Is that right? Am I reading that right?
For September.
Okay.
Just so, for September. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, Rebecca, next slide. This is the Helping Hands distribution. As you can see, we had a pretty heavy increase in activity back in the spring, and then it's dropped down. And I looked at that, and, of course, September dropped off, and October's, although the numbers aren't in, it's been very minimal in the assistance. And frankly, that's simply because there's EAP funds that are out there that are being utilized. But it is nice to know that we still have a healthy balance there going into winter. And I believe that is the last slide, so I'll stop there if there's any questions. All right. Well, thank you. And Steve, I'll turn it back to you.
Okay. I've got two more items, that are a little bit related. So first of all, on a Waputo call last week, and they indicated that the investor-owned utilities have made a commitment at this point to extend their no disconnect, no late fee policy through the end of April. Recall that the current governor's proclamation runs through the end of the year. Certainly, we would expect that seems like the odds are pretty good that the governor may seek to put another proclamation in place. We've not necessarily agreed that the governor has the authority to make those decisions. On the other hand, we have felt that that policy hasn't really had much of a financial impact on us either. And as you can see from John's presentation, we seem to be in pretty good shape. Our customers, maybe it's because of the size of our bills, generally seem to find a way to pay. We have a very low number of customers who are in arrearage. We've done some comparisons against other utilities across the state. You know, our numbers are quite low. So at this point, I would think that we would be it would be appropriate for us to at least consider whether to extend through the end of April. Don't need to make that decision today. We've got some more time. But I did want to put it on the board screen that that's out there and likely going to be an issue that we need to address before the end of the year sometime. Take any questions or comments about that?
This is Steve. The only thing I can say on that, Steve, is that from my standpoint, just reinforcing that our staff is doing what appears to me to look like a great job working with individuals, helping them in any way they can to make it through this difficult time, that we would be in a good shape if the proclamation was made to continue working in that direction because it seems to be paying off. That's my take.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner. Okay, and final item is just a note to a reminder that we did delay rate increases for electric, water, wastewater, fiber customers from the June 1st date that was outlined in the strategic plan to December 1st. We are on track to have those increases go into effect on December 1. The work that needs to be done in terms of billing systems is coming along and is in good shape in order to have that happen. You know, back when we made the decision to delay, we weren't really sure how big of an impact it would be on customers and whether there would be significant financial difficulties that they were incurring. again, given the presentation that John just made, we feel like we're not seeing that out there today. And so it is our expectation that we will proceed with those rate increases on December 1. Any questions about that? And commissioners, just as a way of reminder, we do have the work ongoing to that we described to you last summer, looking at the impact on energy burden customers, those who are paying more than 6% of their income in electricity costs. We have continued to advance that work, particularly with respect to weatherization, low-income energy efficiency programs that could be used to support those customers to help reduce their bills, and are expecting to bring a presentation back to you on that either at the next board meeting or the board meeting following. But our thinking has advanced pretty substantially and should have something for you to consider here fairly soon. And that's it for manager's updates.
Thank you, Steve. So we'll move on to commissioner items. Commissioners, are there any items that you would like to bring to the table at this time? Dennis, I see you've unmuted. Was there something you'd like to share?
No, just in case something came up, I was just getting ready.
So is it possible for us to see each other? Do we need to be looking at the screen we're looking at right now?
Rebecca, can we take the screen off and have just the faces of the commissioners?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now, I didn't mean to say I had any commissioner item. I don't, but I just want to see.
Just hoping that you had something to share, Randy.
Nope.
All right. Well, then, the next item on the agenda is commissioner travel. And Rebecca, are you prepared to present that?
I am. So we're getting close to the end of the year. We don't have many items left. The next coming events are in November, the APPA Cybersecurity Virtual Summit. We have Commissioner Arsenault registered for that. And then, November 18th through 20, the Waputa Association meetings. Those registrations haven't yet been completed, but if you're planning to attend, just let us know and we'll get that done. Those will all be... Okay.
I think we can tell you that right now, Rebecca.
Great.
Randy, I think you're going, right?
Yep.
Any we're talking about going? November and December?
This is November 18 through 20, and these will all be Zoom meetings.
I'll be attending. This is Steve.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is Dennis. I'll be attending.
Okay.
And this is Gary. I will be attending as well.
Great. Commissioner Congdon, are you planning?
I'll have to let you know.
Okay.
Thanks.
And then the last set, the last meeting for the year would be the December 2 through 4 Waputa Annual Conference. And that'll also be a virtual meeting. Who would like to attend that?
Yep, yep. Waving my hand.
Okay.
Probably me. And
yes.
Yes for Steve.
Yes for
and yes. Yes for Gary.
All right. That's everybody. That's what I had.
That's great. Thank you, Rebecca. So the next is follow-up on delegation items from a previous board meeting.
We did not have any from a previous board meeting, or at least from the last board meeting. We did have one from a previous board meeting that we now take off our parking lot list, and that was the request from board members to visit the new substation that would support the Diamond Foundry, and that was completed in October.
Wonderful. Great. And delegation action items from today.
Yeah, we've got five, actually. We're busy with requests today. So we've got information about how trees are removed from lines, adding a metric to the district performance plan to include all items completed and late. I'm sorry, I'm missing that one.
I think it was just the combination of items completed, including those that are late.
Right. So what we would normally do. So we'll make sure we make that happen. The amount of dollars associated with the 4.3% hatchery monitoring and evaluation contract, both the basic amount and the incremental amount. Some information on the long-term financials for the Nine Canyons project, and info on the impact of the 8 new budgeted positions, the budget impact of that. That's what we got. Did we miss anything?
I think that sounds good.
Okay.
So the next item on the agenda is actually any general matters before we move into executive session. Any general matters necessary to come before the commission? Hearing none, we'll be moving into an executive session, and I think we need about an hour. Is that correct, Steve?
Yes.
So we'll need an hour for executive session. Now, Rebecca, can you give us all a real brief? Are we coming, signing out, coming back in to this format?
No, I sent a calendar invite. It's on your calendar at 1:30, but it should be there for you with the conference line number.
So it's a telephone call then?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so we'll all be signing out of this. Okay.
Yes. Okay. Wonderful. Well, thank you, everyone, for your patience and participation in today's meeting. We are going to be going into executive session. Thank you.
No, Commissioner Arsenault, Eric, you need to read the justification for the executive session.
Yes. Eric, thank you so much.
Oh, no.
Going into executive session to discuss legal counsel, agency enforcement action, litigation, potential litigation, to which the court or district may or be likely become a party and or legal risk as authorized by RCW, and to consider this of a site for the acquisition of real estate to buy or lease or purchase when public knowledge regarding such consideration would cause the likelihood of increased price pursuant to the
Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Arsenault, can I just check to make sure, too? I know you did open up for public comment after the public hearing, but we did have on our agenda the normal, is there anyone who would like to make public comment? Would like to just make sure that we make that request, see if there's anyone on the line that would like to make public comment.
Thank you very much.
Okay, there we go. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. We are coming out of executive session. It is November 2nd, 2020. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we will stand adjourned. Thank you, everyone. Have a great day.